Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Mass General Cancer Center, dedicated to providing the latest therapies and cancer specialists who are experienced in your cancer. When you hear the word cancer, their team is ready. Learn more at massgeneral.org/cancer.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, the fracture of the GOP was on full display in a press conference with House Minority Leader McCarthy, a staunch Trump supporter, and Liz Cheney, the third-ranking Republican in the House. When asked whether Trump should speak at CPAC, they awkwardly gave very different answers. NBC political director Chuck Todd joins us on that. And then we'll get your thoughts on Governor Baker's plan to open all schools for in-person instruction beginning in April.
Last year, police in New York pinned Daniel Prude to the ground while he was already handcuffed, hooded, and in the middle of a mental health crisis. This week, a grand jury announced they would not bring charges against the police officers in his death. Andrew Cabral would join us to discuss that and more for another edition of Law & Order. That's ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim. How you doing?
I'm great. I just checked, 37,000-minute wait on the state's vaccine website. So things are, I think it's 37,212. So we'll get back to that.
Good.
Who needs Twitter when you have CPAC? As you know, on Sunday, Trump will take center stage, literally and figuratively, within the Republican Party at the annual Conservative Confab, which kicks off today. Aiming to tighten his grip on Trump loyalists, relitigating, I'm assuming, the 2020 election, and maybe even hinting at a run in 4 years. Joining us online for his take on this and other political headlines is Chuck Todd. Chuck's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That's Channel 10 on most providers. Also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director at NBC News. Hello, Chuck Todd.
Hello there.
Hey.
Well, hello.
Week.
Yeah. You know, how can you miss this guy when he won't go away, right? Okay, so CPAC.
I'm comfortable. I would like to test the premise of how long it will take till I miss him. I don't miss him, Corey. I don't.
Yeah.
Sorry.
What do we make of all this, Chuck? I mean,
Republicans are in love. That's what you make of it.
Is that, well, not all the Republicans are
a
in
lot
love.
Of them.
I mean, my new hero is Liz Cheney. But tell us what you think. What's the analysis here?
No, we're in this, you know, I do believe that if you broke the Republican Party up into three parts, right, you'd have the smallest sliver would be the true anti-Trump wing, right? There's legitimate folks in that lane, Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney, you know. I think Mitch McConnell would like to believe he's in that lane, but I'll discuss that in a minute. You have the ones that are the true Trump sycophants, right? Your Matt Gaetz, and you know, a growing number of these senators, Holly and Cruz, maybe they don't fully, whatever reason it is, they're all in now and they're going to stay all in because they've decided to find their, and then you've got this group in the middle that they were some of the loudest anti-Trump forces in 16. Think Marco Rubio. And yes, I would say think Mitch McConnell, who are afraid of their own voters, right? Like, that's the issue here, is that Trump has done such a good job, along with this conservative, and I don't even want to call it, I respect the word conservative, and so to apply it to the Trump people isn't fair to people like George Will. But yeah. Anyway, so whatever you want to call Trumpism. But they're so, you know, he has done such an effective job at creating sort of conflating conservatism, Trumpism, loyalty to Trump, owning the libs, all in this one category, is that basically the largest chunk of elected officials are simply afraid of their voters. And Trump's got them all. These voters have all decided that, you know, it's Trump's way of the highway. They believe Trump and Trump alone now, or Trump and the conservative echo chamber, you know, is sort of is all in on Trump too, right? Whatever, you know, where the various social media, the phony news sites like Federalist or you know, the infotainment channels like Fox. So it has got a grip on that group of voters, and I think that is why these elected officials are basically acting like Stockholm. They're at this point, it's like a form of Stockholm syndrome. They knew this was bad in 16, Kevin McCarthy and Marco Rubio, right? But they've gone along now because they want to stay in office.
You know, by the way, I'm going to bet $100 that he beats Fidel Castro's four-hour speech record on Sunday, but we'll find out at the end of the day. You know, despite the lunacy of all this, when you look at, correct me if I'm wrong, obviously they need one Senate seat in 2022, even though I know the numbers arguably favor the Democrats, only, I think, six seats in the House. And it seems Trump's greatest power is in these down-ballot races. If he sticks around, America could have Joe Biden with a Republican House and Senate in a couple of years, which suggests to me, forget bipartisanship, Joe Biden, go big and go alone on everything until you can't anymore.
Well, it'll be a war under that. I mean, the scenario you're painting, you know, they'll have articles of impeachment drawn up under that scenario. Don't think they won't. Right. If Trump is the guy that leads the Republic, if it's sort of the Trump wing that gets Republicans control of the House and Senate, right, and it's sort of pretty clear it's the Trump wing that did it. Oh, I think you're looking. That's your next. Now, I just happen to believe we're in an exact reverse situation.
Meaning?
I think the more Trump's involved, the more likely Democrats hold.
Really?
Yes. It's been proven.
Trump because of the suburbs or what, Chuck? What do you mean?
Yes,
why?
Because number one, because of the Senate seats that are on the table. Number two, because one thing we've learned, when Trump's not on the ballot, no matter, you know, Trump-like figures don't do well. When Trump's on the ballot, Trump-like figures can do okay. But he won't be on the ballot. But he may influence who is. So if he's winning all these primaries, basically if his people win all these primaries, well, then he is setting it up where it is easier for Democrats to win some of these swing. I mean, what they're going through now, and if you know, Wisconsin is going to be a Trumpy nominee. Ohio's going to be a Trumpy nominee. We're not sure about Pennsylvania, and we're not sure right now about North Carolina. But if Laura Trump ends up there, that'll be the ultimate test. And I'll tell you, I think the Laura Trump candidacy is a absolute disaster for the GOP messaging wise, because an actual Trump, because it will label the entire party the Trump party. And that might help in some parts of the electorate, but I think it will be a problem overall. And it will, you know, it's possible that they're basically as close as they can get with Trump in the House and Senate.
You're making Marjorie's day, Chuck Todd. So
yeah,
Chuck,
you
have firsthand experience. I remember, and Marjorie does too, we were talking about it like it was yesterday, your great interview with Ron Johnson,
about
a month
wonderful.
Ago, where you called him something like an arsonist for starting the election doubt fire, whatever. I'm watching this lunatic the other day at this hearing, and you know, he's not from, I'm going to take crap for this, he's not from Alabama, he's not from Arkansas, he's from Wisconsin. And it is so insane. He's reading, a blog post from one nut suggesting that these are fake Trump people. What was your takeaway from that performance the other
day? Here's what I will tell you. So you brought up the interview I did with him. A colleague of his called me after the interview aired on Meet the Press. Okay? A Senate colleague of his. And I'm not going to say who. It was off the record conversation and all of that stuff. But the senator did tell me one thing that I needed to know factually, because I asked the question, what happened to him?
Yeah.
Because the guy we all knew in his first term was not the guy we now know in his second term. And it's like dramatic. And this senator told me that 18 months ago, and again, I want to be careful here, because he just said, he goes, look, none of us can figure it out, but we've all been talking, because he has changed more than most. But he said about 18 months ago, all senators were warned that the Russians were trying to essentially plant this Ukrainian propaganda with elected officials to try to, you know, continue to paint the picture that somehow maybe it was Ukraine, not Russia, in the 2016 election, right? Basically the entire premise of what we ended up with. And it was just sort of alarming to hear a senator essentially openly wonder, I have no other explanation other than why he seems to be all of a sudden espousing some sort of talking point that benefits not America, right? And so it is strange behavior. All I will tell you is I can't tell you how many times from multiple people, Republicans and Democrats that have known him, who have specifically on him, they go, we don't know what happened. Something changed with him.
Wow.
Well, let's hope something changes
unnerving.
Back.
You know,
it's unnerving.
Before we leave this, Liz Cheney is very conservative. I am not very conservative. But I do love the fact that the woman who seems to have the most testosterone in this whole bunch is, you know, a woman,
right.
Usually, you know.
Well, haven't we learned that in the Democratic side of the aisle, too, right?
Nancy Pelosi. That's a good point, Nancy Pelosi.
Right? Like, yep. Who are the toughest leaders, right?
Yes.
You know, is it McConnell and Schumer or is it Pelosi and Cheney? I'll take Pelosi and Cheney, right? You know, I want to be in their bunker. I wouldn't want to be in the other guy's bunkers.
Well, just review this little exchange between her and that really humiliation central guy, Kevin McCarthy, about CPAC yesterday when they were both talking in the hallway.
I have to say, I give McCarthy credit for his little aside after she spoke.
I agree.
Well, on that note, yeah, I mean, it was just sort of, you know.
I
was good committee timing. You're like, you know what? That's about the best way you can deal with that. You're like, well, on that happy note.
Well, you know, it's also great. I'm sure you picked up the visual. He heads off in one direction with his entourage, and she walks off by herself in the other direction, which sort of says it all.
But we should just tell listeners. I mean, he basically said it was fine for Trump to go to CPAC, and she says, I'm paraphrasing, but there's no room in the Republican Party for him. I mean, she is really tough about this, and it's really inspiring to see somebody so unequivocally and without hesitation and with such strength stand up to this guy. And you're right.
You know, it's like watching somebody who finally quit smoking.
Yeah.
And then they become an evangelist for it.
Yeah. That's a great analogy. Yeah.
No, but they're annoying. And she is
Mitt
not
Romney,
annoying.
By the way, Mitt Romney, Adam Kinzinger, Liz Cheney, right? All of them have been, you could just feel the minute they finally like, you know what, I'm out, right?
Yeah.
Then they're just like, they're letting it loose. They're letting it fly.
You know, Chuck Todd, can we discuss one other senator who I have to admit my bias. You don't know this, but listeners do. I have not been a Joe Manchin fan because this is a guy, as I said yesterday, who opposes the $15 minimum wage but was defending his daughter when, as CEO of her company, she raised the price of the EpiPen from $100 to $600. So that's fine, but people shouldn't have a living wage. Having said that, so I'm sort of transparent, this guy is essentially running America right now. And I don't even know what to say about it, but as the 50th Democratic vote, he decides what the direction of the United States of America is. And there's no reason to think that other than in individual cases, when he said he was going to vote for Holland, for example, other than individual cases, he can stop any train, virtually any train he chooses to stop, right?
I think so. Yeah, no, he's got a lot of power, and I don't think he's going to be afraid to wield it. And I think he sort of, you know, this is, you know, don't forget, West Virginia, you know, he replaced in the Senate, people forget this, Bob Byrd.
I forgot this.
Who always knew how to wield,
yeah.
You know, I know, Byrd lasted so long that the special election to replace him was Manchin, who decided to run in that seat. Anyway, so he watched Bob Byrd. This is how, and in many ways, this was good politics in West Virginia. You want to know why a Democrat survives there? If you remind them you know how to wield power, they respect that. There is a lot of, you know, so I think this is good politics for Joe Manchin, for what it's worth. And I think that's at the end of the day, whether you like it or not, hey, he figured out how to be a Democrat and win in West Virginia, and that's why you have the majority. You know what I mean? It's sort
that's
of like
point, yeah.
Everything comes – And look, the Democratic Party is America's big tent party. From Bernie Sanders to Joe Manchin, it really is pretty big tent right now. The small tent is on the right side of the aisle. You know, they don't have that kind of ideological diversity within their ranks. But it also, I mean, I think the single hardest job in Washington is Chuck Schumer's. Mm-hmm. I really do. You know, in any moment in time, as we're finding out, because he's got to constantly keep Manchin happy. He apparently has no good relationship with Susan Collins anymore. That'll get better. That always happens after a campaign cycle. It just happens. You know, that stuff takes a while to heal, but it'll heal. But right now, so he doesn't have any margin of error. He doesn't have a you know, Republicans that might help bail him out every now and then if he loses one. You know, occasionally there's a Murkowski, but right now Collins isn't somebody, you know, to
Hold
go
on.
At. And so I think, yeah.
Hold on. I was just going to say, she's another somebody with some guts there, and I don't know enough about her, but
Murkowski.
She seems to have some principles, too. Lisa Murkowski from Alaska. She's got a massive amount of power because she could vote with the Democrats sometimes.
Well, I was just going to say, she faced down the Tea Party and won.
Yeah.
Well, that's right.
And remember, the Tea Party in 2010 was Trump, is now what the Trump wing is. So she already proved she can do this. You know, she doesn't need the Republican Party. And frankly, Mitch McConnell has figured that out, too, which is why he actually is very protective of her. He will never let people go after her. In the same way, I think that you'll watch Schumer and, you know, this is going to be an interesting game. I don't know if you caught the interview Ron Klain did last night on MSNBC.
No.
But, you know, he was constantly baited to trash Manchin and he wouldn't do it.
Really?
And you're never going to see it. Well, because, my God, you want to, you know, that's the fastest way to see your agenda torpedoed.
Yeah.
Hey, Chuck Todd, in the last minute or so, we all know Ted Cruz, at least temporarily, is in trouble. I think his Republican support in Texas dropped something like 20 percentage points. Mm-hmm. In the last minute, is Cuomo in trouble, or is this a momentary thing in New York?
I think he's culturally out of sync. I think he's going to be culturally kicked out of the Democratic Party, and I'd say this. This, whatever you want to call it, that behavior, in the same way that Bill Clinton's behavior wouldn't be tolerated in today's Democratic Party or wouldn't be forgiven or whatever, I don't think this is going to be forgiven. However, you got to understand something about Andy Cuomo. He will cling to power. And so this is going to be, I think, an extraordinarily uncomfortable year for New York Democrats. Remember who the first person to call on Al Franken to resign was?
Gillibrand.
Junior senator from New York. No, I think this is going to be a long, tough, rough year for New York Democrats because I don't think Cuomo will make this easy. If there is a movement that says it would be better if they moved on, I don't think Cuomo lives in that world. But I'll tell you something else. He's facing the same fourth-term curse his father faced.
Boy, that's a great point.
You know, you really shouldn't try for the fourth term at your own peril. If he had already announced he wasn't seeking re-election, I don't know I wonder if they would have, if some of these folks who want to settle a score or two, who are just worn out, and I don't blame them, right? I mean, look, Andy Cuomo and Cruz are both victims of their own jerkiness in their own way. You know, you reap what you sow sometimes, and we talked about the golden rule earlier. You know, he loves to dunk on people when they're down. And now people are dunking on him when he's down.
Were they ever? Chuck Todd, pleasure as always. Talk to you next week.
Hey, thank you, Chuck.
Take care.
Bye, guys. Yep.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Chuck Todd is the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10, on most providers. Must viewing for We News Hounds. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and political director for NBC News. Coming up, we're opening the lines, asking all parents, are you prepared and willing to write off an entire school year, or are you rooting for the push by the governor and the education secretary to get the kids back at their desks? That conversation is next. A couple of vaccine tales on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're going to talk in a minute about, as Marjorie said, about what's going on with the schools, the Baker-Riley plan. Before we do, the reason we're not focusing on COVID and the vaccine website, let's call it SNAFU this morning, is because the governor's testifying as we speak. We're monitoring that at a legislative oversight hearing, and who knows what's going to happen there. I just want to say, I don't think I've said, I did get my first shot, and it was great at Gillette. And by the way, the CIC people... CIC Health that are running the show there it is like clockwork. It is so beautifully, respectfully done. Every one of the staff people is great, and so I want to say that to begin with. And so, are you looking at me? What are you saying?
Something? I'm going Sunday.
Oh, you are? Oh, great.
Yes, I am. I'm very excited about it.
But having said that, and
my
the good news...
My kid got me the slot, by the way.
That's great. That's great. And the fact
After
that...
I gave up.
That the I don't even know how to do this. It didn't crash. That's the good news today. But I'm sure everybody is already here. I went on this morning purely because I knew we might talk about it at some point today. And as soon as I went on, it was 34-minute wait because they have that new feature where you get in line, which is fabulous, by the way. It went from 34 to 42 minutes, which is perfectly fine. Then it went to 5,000 minutes. And then it went to 37,000 minutes. And then it went down to 80 minutes. And then it went back to 5,000 minutes. I think the bottom line is his problem with the website. And I assume the governor is going to be asked these questions. His opening remarks about 5 minutes ago, he said, I said the vaccination process would be lumpy and bumpy. That's what happens when you do something that's never been done before. And I'll just end this by saying, even though there are a lot of complaints on the show and a lot of flaws, again, the first poll that came out, 71 or 73% of the people in Massachusetts approve of how the state, how the governor's administration is handling the vaccine. So that's the deal. We're going to move on from that. We'll keep giving you updates throughout the day. What's up?
I just got to share one email from Barbara from Brookline early this morning who said, I just wasted 4 hours of my life trying to sign up for this website. I feel like Sisyphus, you know, the person that was rolling the boulder up the hill and got to the top and had to start all over again. Appointment is open. Then one can sign up. Then one is back at the website and one is open again. And then it's gone. And you repeat, repeat, repeat for 4 hours.
Well, since you're saying that, I got tweeted by a 38-year-old neighbor of mine who's been trying to get her parents on. And she texted me. I don't have it in front of me, but she essentially texted me this morning and said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm on the site. I'm going to go to Cancun for the weekend, come back, and then my turn should be next in line. In any case.
I shouldn't be laughing because it's not funny, but it's
horrible.
What else are you going to do?
So in any case, for the topic at hand, in Massachusetts, elementary students could be back in school full time by April if the governor and the education commissioner, that's Jeff Riley, have their way. You probably know yesterday Riley made this decision to reopen schools by factoring in the vaccine rollout, he said, a decline in cases and the availability of pool testing for many, well, not many, but for all school districts, about half of which have taken it. He is requesting authority to essentially order in-person learning starting in April, beginning with elementary students and then extended to middle and high schoolers returning by the end of the school year. I don't know if he would commit to the high schoolers, but at least middle schoolers. Parents have the option to have their kids continue to work remotely through the end of the year. It's up to them. And districts that need to take a more gradual approach to going full-time in-person can apply for waivers to start out with a hybrid model. So we're taking your calls on this. Parents, teachers, students, administrators, whoever, 877-301-8970. Are you on board with the governor and Jeff Riley's call? Are you on board with the plan? Are you hesitant, though, about returning to school full-time? Or could this not come soon enough for you? 877-301-8970. Let me just explain one more thing if people aren't clear. He is essentially asking for authority to override any decision about a local school board in terms of when and how they open, and basically saying you can't do remote and hybrid anymore unless you get a waiver or unless an individual parent requests it. So it's a rare sort of statewide mandate rather than local school committees making decisions about this. 877-301-8970. By the way, I want to put one thing to rest that Marjorie has been harping on. I had the president of the Mass Teachers Association on last night with me and the president of Boston Teachers Union.
Oh, God, I missed your show, Jim. I'm sorry.
Well, no, but the most important thing, I asked the question outright, are either of you suggesting vaccination of all of your members is a precondition for returning to the classroom? And both of them answered unequivocally, no. They'd love to be vaccinated.
Well, that's great.
They'd like to have a higher priority. They cited the CDC urging but not requiring as a precondition that teachers be vaccinated. They're concerned, as Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers, told us a couple of weeks ago, that all the mitigation stuff, you know, from the ventilation to the distancing to whatever is in place, that's their focus.
Okay, well, let me just ask you two quick questions then before
Please.
We take the calls at 877-301-8970. So that means that they are not where the head of the Massachusetts American Federation of Teachers is. It says that teachers need to be vaccinated in their own communities.
I'm not going to do this again. She was on with us. She never said that. She never,
no,
ever
said
that to
us. You had the MTA and the Boston Teachers Union.
Boston Teachers Union is part of the American Federation of Teachers. And
okay,
Randy Weingarten, I'm sorry he didn't say that to us. But in any case, let's
no,
move
that's
on.
No, that's not the one. That's the one in Massachusetts. That they have a deal with the firefighters to be vaccinated in their own communities. Maybe you didn't know about
no,
that.
No, they do. She mentioned it last night. And they would like that to happen. Let me say again.
But they're,
I asked
not,
them
they're
outright,
not insisting upon
if
it.
If they don't, aren't vaccinated, but the other mitigation things are met. Their other concern, which, by the way, I am 100% behind. When Baker and Riley announced this yesterday, between the two teachers unions, they represent, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 170,000 school employees. Do you know how much notice they got of this announcement of a reopening come April? Do you know how much notice they got?
They heard about it in the news like everybody else.
They heard
probably.
About it in the news, exactly, which is not the way to deal with representatives of people, whether you agree with them or not, who represent almost 200,000 school employees. 877-301-8970. Yes.
But the other important question is, we have been hearing about this mitigation for so long. What is it, money that's the holdup?
Some places are doing it, some aren't. Some buildings are so old they feel they can't do it.
Okay.
Some now they're talking about 3-foot distancing. Other scientists are talking about 6 feet distancing. The one thing that is unequivocally clear is the science is suggesting that there is a very low transmission rate in schools. In fact, what I learned yesterday, and then we'll move to the calls, two states, North Carolina and Wisconsin, I hope I'm right about it. Yes, North Carolina and Wisconsin, when they were in the red zone, meaning where the community transmission rates were really, really high, they opened their schools regardless. In those red zone times, the transmission rate in the schools, in the classrooms, was lower than in the surrounding community. The point is that the science is, I am very sensitive, as you know, to the health issues of people who work in school buildings.
Right.
But the fact is, the science suggests it's, for the most part, a safer place to be than in the community at large.
And may I just add briefly, we have been hearing from teachers throughout who are exhausted, understandably, because they're trying to teach remote, they're trying to teach kids at home, they're trying to teach kids in the schoolroom, they're tearing their hair out. This is incredibly difficult for teachers. But the second thing that's unequivocal is that the best interests of the children have come second here, because we have been hearing throughout, kids of color, poor kids, don't have computers, can't get on the Zoom, mental health problems, everything else. So I think that the children have been put second long enough. I think it's time
I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, I think if you have sick teachers or educators and people, it doesn't contribute. There is no question you're right that the mental health issues, is a great story in the Globe this morning, for kids that are doing remote or hybrid learning are up exponentially. It's a problem. But there, on every end of this equation, there are issues. By the way, can I give you an update?
I think the kids have to come first before the adults.
I agree, but
I
don't agree that they're not. In any case.
They're not? The kids are the ones that we know have already been severely damaged. That's what we know about the children's fate.
Yeah. Let me just give you one update, by the way. Yesterday we had Tanya Bosek on, who was dealing with, you know, a planet that may have had life, Mars, what, it was 3-4 billion years ago. I just checked the website. That's how long you have to wait to get an appointment under it's a give or take. Judy in Arlington. It's not quite that bad, but Judy, and by the way, the mass.gov, I should have said, tweeted that virtually all the appointments are gone, which is not surprising, considering there are only 50,000 made available today. All you can do is provide what you got. Judy in Arlington, sorry to make you wait. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, no worries. I have two actual real-life experiences with my sister and my friend who's a teacher that will shed light on some of this confusion. I also feel like the community-by-community way of dealing with schools reminds me of the vaccine rollout, you know, where some places are much better than others. But I do love unions, but the teachers' union seems to be standing in the way of educating, especially special needs kids. So my sister is homeschooling her grandchildren in Western Mass in areas that have been in the gray area, like low COVID, since the beginning. They refused to open the schools at all for in person. Her grandchildren are suffering so much. She is a nurse practitioner, master's person. She can't get the resources she needs for them. And she gets super pushback because they're afraid of the union. Then my friend in Waltham has been working since the beginning. Waltham is teaching ELL kids, unvaccinated. So what's wrong with that picture? So that's, I feel like that's what people are really mad at, is the inequity.
Yeah.
And depending on the local union representation. But this Western Mass thing has been driving me nuts, knowing that they don't have COVID virtually, and they will not let the kids into school at all.
And well, that, Judy, let me interrupt you and say if Riley gets his way, local school committees in Western Mass won't have that discretion. They can apply for a waiver, but my guess is if the circumstances are as you describe, the waiver won't be granted. Judy, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970 is our number.
Annie from Marshfield, thank you for calling.
Hi, Annie.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
Full disclosure, I tend to be a look on the bright side person.
Good. We could use that.
What are you doing here then? Go ahead.
I use you guys to balance out.
Okay.
My son has been hybrid learning, so 2 days in school, 3 days remote, up until this week. So after February vacation, they went back, both cohorts, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and then full remote on Wednesday. And I have to actually say our experience has been overall positive. I have found the teachers to be super helpful, super kind, super Great. Positive. But as a parent, I feel much more connected to my son's education than I did before. I have a much better handle on the way that they are teaching him. I feel like I can support him at home in ways that I don't think I would have ever been exposed to without this experience. That's not to say it has not had its trials. We have not had, we've had, you know, knock down, throw down, tears and fights about getting the work done.
I bet.
But in general, you know, even though he's behind and his whole class is behind and all of those things, I think that we've all been exposed to what's going to eventually be some really valuable resources to better support our kids' public school education.
But Annie, but I know you know this, but I feel the need to throw it in. Because of the need on the part of so many families in this country to do what you're doing, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million women in this country have had to leave their jobs full time and so I'm saying even if they quote, to use your concept, quote, benefited from the experience as much as you did, they benefited on one hand, but they are suffering hugely on the other, right?
Absolutely. Yes, yeah. I've had to sit way back, and luckily I work for a small business, and my boss, who also has 3 kids, has been extraordinarily supportive, and I know that we are lucky and the exception to the rule in this situation. Mm. So, again, I try to take the positive from it. I am super happy that he is back there 4 days a week. It is definitely better for his social and emotional health.
That's great.
But I do know that it has come at a cost to me and a lot of my peers who have not been as lucky and who have had to struggle a lot more than we have.
Annie, thanks for your thoughts. We really appreciate it. By the way, I bet a lot of people feel like Annie does. I mean, you obviously you're immersed in your kids' education, for better or worse. Annie thinks for better. And I guess, you know, that is a benefit of an otherwise truly unfortunate time.
You know, we just got an email from Amy who's saying that her daughter is very, very worried about going back to school. She's anxious about it because, you know, you don't know if you're going to get sick in there, too. It's important to point out that parents like Amy will still have the option to keep their kids at home if they want
right,
to.
Right, right, right. By the way, I'm so glad you brought that up, because one thing I'm mortified that I did not realize, that I was preparing. I have 2 women on tonight who've run this fabulous book for 8 to 12-year-olds. I'll talk more about it later, to deal with the mental health issues while they're at home learning. And what I never thought about until I was reading in anticipation for that is, while I think we all agree, including you and me, that if it's safe, getting kids back in the classroom is better, they both are deal with the psychological side and say that transition is also going to be hard for kids. You know, after a year, for the most part, not being in the classroom, particularly for young kids, having them back in has issues that need addressing, too. I don't know what they are. But those who have expertise in this area say they can't be taken for granted, that, you know, just the return is going to be all sweetness and light kind of thing. I guess that's the point I was trying to make.
Linda in Norwood, thank you for calling.
Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so stuck in the middle with this. It's, I've got two family members that are teachers, and they have told me their concerns about, you know, one of them goes in like half a day and whatever. Mm-hmm. And her concerns about getting sick and, you know, all that. And then I've got two grandchildren that are virtual. And both of them are sinking. They're just sinking.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, the younger one was an honor roll student.
That's horrible.
And her report card came out, and she is just... I mean, she sits there, she's looking at the screen, but there's just too many. My daughter and son-in-law have to work, so, and I'm in a duplex, so I go mm-hmm. over and the TV's on, and she's got the, you know, so I go over and switch the TV off. There's just, you know, and one of them is sort of has learning disabilities and needs extra help.
Mm-hmm.
And is sort of embarrassed to ask so many questions, on, you know, online. And yet I've got two teachers that convince me that their lot in life is not all that great. I just don't know.
Linda,
how
can I tell you,
good.
Linda, can I, as someone who's, I know, worried about your grandkids, I happen not to agree with what this woman wrote, but you should read a piece that's online from the Boston Globe magazine. I think her name is Christine Koh. K-O-H, I hope I have that right. Someone please correct me and brighten if
I'm
wrong.
Yeah, it is Christine Koh, K-O-H.
Where she says that she has zero expectations for her kids during this year. And again, while I don't agree with her conclusion, she makes a pretty compelling argument for that side of things, that we should stop the hand-wringing. It is what it is. So I would urge you to read what she wrote, and it may make you feel a little better. Linda, thank you for sharing your travail with us. We appreciate it.
Well, you know, I think it goes without saying these kids are going to be way, way behind, because we talk all the time about how just taking off July and August,
right,
kids wind up getting way behind. But to me, the thing is, these poor kids have been out of school, some of them for almost a year. And I think the damage to them already is overwhelming. And when the science says that it's safe to go back into schools, and we've all lauded Dr. Fauci without vaccinations, when there are the mitigations, you can't do the carve out. You can't say everybody else, you know, has to do this, except for the teachers, especially when these kids and the special need kids particularly are suffering so much. I mean, to me, that's the issue. Plus, as I said before, some these poor teachers, they're trying to do everything here, right? They're trying to do teach kids on a screen, teach kids in the home, go in some days, not go in some days. And then you got the mothers, and it's mostly the mothers, who, as you said before, have lost their jobs. They've lost their income. They cannot do it. So it's just, it's just a no-brainer now. People are going to get vaccinated. Teachers are right. They should be up in the 65-year-old group they're with now.
Oops, Marjorie froze. And by the way, just to finish Marjorie's thought while she's getting unfrozen, since unless they're over 65 teachers, they're in the next group, they will not have received, unless they get Johnson & Johnson, their second dose and be fully protected probably until the end of the school year, based upon what the governor is saying is the rollout time. It appears we're taking a break, Marjorie.
We're taking a break. That's right. We are talking about the Baker administration push to reopen schools, asking you, are you on board with his plan or not? This is 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about reopening schools. You know, the governor and the commissioner of education yesterday announced their plan to essentially order all school districts to reopen classrooms, in-person classrooms, beginning with elementary kids starting in April, regardless of what local school committees think. They could get a waiver, but if it's not granted, they have to comply. We're taking your calls asking if this makes sense to you at 877-301-8970.
Just briefly, let me change the subject. Pat from Gloucester just said she was 30,000th and something in the queue at 7:15 this morning for the 50,000 slots and couldn't get one. But she just got a text from, as she calls it, her healthcare conglomerate, Beth Israel Lahey, inviting her to get an appointment tomorrow. One click, she's got it.
Wow.
She's very happy.
Well, you know, the hospitals, on that note, finally, after lobbying really hard, were included back in the distribution mix after Baker and Mary Lou Sutter's cut them off. So about a week or so ago. What?
I'm sure Governor Baker's having a very good day today.
Well, for whatever it's worth, I don't know if he's having a good day or not. We're about a half hour into the hearing. He's being asked some tough questions. The first question was from the vice chair, Cindy Friedman, said she was baffled by the vaccine rollout. She's a vice chair of the committee. I can say, as someone who's been deeply involved in the process, I'm completely at a loss for what is going on at times. She can't tell her constituents, she says, when they'll get vaccinated. It's highly troubling, so unnecessary. I feel like it's self-inflicted wounds. But in response to that, we are, in terms of first doses, according to the governor, we're now amongst the top five states. There's some serious concerns about the equity of the shots in the arms and how they're going overwhelmingly into white arms, not to black and brown ones. But he has picked up the pace. The question
he's picked
is,
up the pace,
has he picked it up in the right places?
But I cannot imagine his reaction when he found out that you were getting the word that you had 30,000 minutes to wait or whatever it was.
I'm sure it's what he said to us last week when he was here. It was a week ago today when he said his hair was on fire and he's pissed off. Justine
from Medford. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Justine.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a kindergartner and a first grader, and they're doing remote learning. Medford has both hybrid and remote, and we opted for remote at the beginning of the year because we weren't so sure, you know, about sending them in. But it does seem like it's pretty safe. And Medford actually has been doing its own testing, and to me, it looks really good. So if it were to happen, I would probably send my kids. But I am concerned that the teachers and all the school staff, the people who work in the cafeteria,
sure,
the janitors, like, they should all be vaccinated. And, you know, if they all got vaccinated next week, they wouldn't be, you know, fully covered from the 2 weeks after the second vaccine till like mid-April, right? So
right.
I'm thinking, like, unless they push it up for them, maybe they could start after April vacation week. But that's my concern, is like, I feel like for the people who work in the schools, they should be vaccinated, you know, and that would help possibly reduce any potential transmission more. You know, the teachers are the ones, I think, who, first of all, they're more at risk just due to age, but also in terms of spreading it, they're the ones who are doing the most talking all day long. And so, anyway, you know, I just kind of have mixed feelings about it.
Well, Justine, the thinking of why is the 65-year-olds and over is because older people are most likely to die. And it's the rare teacher who's still working at 65 years old. They're younger than that for the most part. So that was the governor's original thinking. But I think now there's such a push to get these kids back into school. It does seem to me throw the teachers into the same group with the 65 and
older. Do you think, but by the way, Justine, thank you for your thoughts. We really appreciate it. Do you think there's a snowball's chance in hell he's going to agree to do that? He added a million people when just last Thursday, he added a million people to the eligibility list for the 65 pluses,
right,
and the two comorbidities or more. He gets 130,000 doses a week. If every one of those million people, not to mention the people already at the top of the line, if every one of them decided to be vaccinated, that's like, that's 8 weeks. That's 2 months where he's going to add another, 200 or 250,000 educators to the list? I'm not arguing for or against it. I just think it's virtually impossible that he's going to do it.
But you see his thinking. I can see his thinking. Well, if you are over 65
years
old,
it's the CDC's thinking.
Exactly, and you've got two comorbidities.
Sure,
you are most likely to die.
Correct,
and get so that's the reason for it. And again, you understand why, you know, maybe a 50-year-old teacher or a 55-year-old teacher that's getting close to that age would be very concerned. But that teacher, based on the science, is less likely to get seriously ill or die. So that, I mean,
well,
it's not
except you
illogical.
You can't just do age, Marjorie. That 50-year-old, as opposed to another 50-year-old, is going to go into a room with 20 or 30 kids
who are
going to be 3 feet apart, hopefully masked and all that sort of thing. He or she is entering a different physical environment than the average 50-year-old. That's I think, the difference.
Well, again, we have a lot of people that are essential workers that have been working full-time during this whole situation.
Oh, I agree. And they're in the same group as teachers, right, in terms of the priority list.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is here, everybody's upset. I think with the way, if they're not in the group, they're upset. Molly from Dover, thank you for calling.
Hi, Molly.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
So we have two kids. One is in first grade and one was supposed to start preschool this year. However, we chose to keep the four-year-old out. We started the first grader on remote. Due to that, my mother-in-law, who was high risk and 77, lived with us, mm-hmm. and we just didn't know how she would feel.
Yeah.
We didn't know what was going on. You know, we had our own concerns about it, so we started him remote. That did not go well. He had a hard time. My mom from Rhode Island was coming up to help us while I was going into my office 2 days a week because I work full time. I had to cut back because we have two children now home. And, you know, it was really, really hard to see somebody who loved school and being in school just spiraling, you know, downward. Mm. And my husband and I were like, I just can't do this anymore. We can't do this.
So what did you do?
We put them back in. We decided to do it right before Thanksgiving. The parents are not allowed in the building. We have to drop them off. He has to wear a mask every day. I don't even know what the actual school looks like the day there because I'm not allowed to be in the building. But he's so much happier.
Oh, wow.
It's like night and day difference between, you know, what we saw during remote and what we're seeing now while he's going in school full time.
Well, your kid, if I may, and I'm sort of making Marjorie's argument too, but your kid is exactly the case study of, I assume, why Jeff Riley and Charlie Baker say, starting with elementary kids, we want them back in school. And the governor, by the way, yesterday during this announcement, talked about the mental health state or mental state, particularly of young kids. And, you know, your kid's a perfect example, and it's actually great to hear your kids happy and doing well. So, Molly, thank you for sharing the story. I hope it continues. That way. I mean, can you imagine yourself when you were a young kid? I mean, it's impossible to put yourself in that place, learning on a computer. I mean, when I said that to a friend the other day, he said, well, if you don't know anything else like her, well, of course, her first grader, it sounds like, went to preschool. But if you're a young kid who has no other experience, then I guess you can deal with it. But if you've had an in-person experience and you have friends sitting next to you, and all of a sudden you don't, it's really hard.
Jane on the Cape, thanks for calling.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, first-time caller, long-time listener.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I had 2 points I wanted to make. I'm a former school administrator, and I want to say that in some communities, the budgets are always tight, and the question comes up, should we do facilities maintenance? Or should we hire the extra mental health counselor? So that's the choice that many districts are in. But then I wanted to say that, in my mind, there's a big difference between the faculty and the union. Some unions want to make things difficult and just for fun. And others are good. But I always felt that the faculty was willing to do more than I knew than the union would allow them to do. So that's my 2 cents worth.
Well, before you leave, I feel I have to have you on the phone before, so I don't say it after you're gone. I used to be a union president. I never encountered a union that wanted to make trouble just for fun. I mean, doesn't mean that you can't criticize their tactics, and I'm totally fine with that, and I've done some of that myself too. But I don't know unions, particularly in the public sector, that do things just to create havoc.
Well, I would disagree with that profoundly.
Based on what?
I would say teachers' unions represent teachers. That's their first concern, is the teachers.
No, but that isn't what Jane said. Jane said, you know, just
doing
for fun.
Doing things for fun? Yeah. I think it's doing things, well, maybe, Jane, I don't know if you meant for fun or for gain for the people that they're representing. I can certainly think that the unions for some public unions in Massachusetts have been very generous to their unions at the expense mm-hmm. of taxpayers, and politicians have fallen for it. But I'm not sure what you mean by fun, Jane. Do you mean it to just help the teachers or monetarily or
no, what I mean is that they obstruct progress just because yeah. they can't.
I would agree with that. I think the teachers unions have gotten in the way of reforms in schools that would help the kids. But again, their first obligation is not to the kids, it's to the teachers.
Okay, but luckily we're almost out of time, so we're not going to get in a big fight. But I will say to you what I've said for the 20 years we worked together.
Mm-hmm.
For those teachers and those public employees to get those outrageous increases, did they unilaterally steal the money from the city or town treasury? Or did the man or woman who runs the town say, yes, we agree to give you these wages and benefits?
Well,
it's the latter.
I would say in the context
Why don't you criticize
COVID,
them, Marjorie?
Here's what I would say, Jim. In the context of COVID-19, the people who have unequivocally suffered the most are kids. And that's why I think it's time to put their interests first instead of the interests of the adults.
Okay. I agree with you. We just disagree about how you get from here to there, I guess. That's where we are. But I want to say it again. If you have a complaint, please don't complain just about the union. Complain about the management entity that gave the union what you think is unreasonable.
Well, let's complain about the people that they're tightest with, Jim. The Democrats.
I'm 100%
fine with
that.
I'll say this for the Republicans. They are not in the tank with the teachers' unions, and I think that's not necessarily
true. Right, they're
true
in
the
tank with Marjorie Taylor Greene. That's right. That's correct. Yes, we got to go.
Okay, so is it QAnon or the teachers' union? That's your choice. Coming up, a Supreme Court decision delayed.
I didn't
is
say
justice
that.
Denied?
Did.
Did Mary Crumlin find it get his revenge on the GOP during this confirmation hearing? Andrew Cabral is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, weeks after Myanmar's military took over control of the country from the civilian government, Facebook has banned them from its site. Facebook has been criticized for years for not taking action against the military as they incited hatred against the country's Muslim minority. Tech writer Andy Anako will join us to discuss what Facebook's action in Myanmar actually means.
As COVID-19 declines in Massachusetts, education officials have announced they want to bring kids back to the classroom full-time by April. State officials said they were compelled to step in out of concern for mental health and loss of learning for students who've largely been out of the classroom for nearly a year. Former Education Secretary Paul Revel joins to discuss that and more ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Egan, you're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
I want to give one single update on the oversight hearing. Eric Lesser, a senator, said to the governor, you described the vaccine rollout as lumpy and bumpy. It hasn't been lumpy and bumpy. It's been a failure. To which Baker says it's going to continue to be vexing and troubling. But as long as supply remains where it is, people are going to continue struggling to get shots. I just want to say quickly, if there was a centralized pre-registration site like West Virginia and so many other states where everybody registers today or tomorrow and you don't have to rush in panic every Thursday morning for one of the 50 or 60,000 available appointments, but rather the state reaches out to you when it's your turn, I think the stress level would go down exponentially, and still haven't heard a good reason why we don't have it. Maybe it'll come up at today's hearing. But first, joining us online for this week's edition of Law & Order is Andrew Cabral. Andrew is the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. She's now the CEO of Ascend. Hello there, Andrea.
That was an excellent point. And hello to you and Marjorie.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Andrea Cabral. Great to talk to you. So Virginia lawmakers have finally voted to abolish the death penalty. This is a big deal, Andrea Cabral. Explain, elaborate on that.
Well, Virginia was and has been actually probably for, I don't even know how long, probably since, you know, Reconstruction, has been the leading state in executions. Well, at least they led for many, many, many years. I think recently they probably fell out of the top spot. But they very recently decided to abolish the death penalty, which to some degree came as a surprise just because of their history, but is seen as a very sort of progressive move by them, given their history. And, you know, it's sort of interesting. You know what you know about states that have the death penalty, and what you know about them is usually in statistics, right? How many people were executed, how many people are on death row. But Tim Kaine, who has got to be one of the most decent elected officials we probably had in public life in the country, wrote a really interesting op-ed piece in the Washington Post because, you know, he was governor there. And, you know, he now represents Virginia in the Senate, about the history of the death penalty in Virginia and, you know, this sort of long-standing fight. He is literally – he was an attorney – for people who don't know, he was an attorney for a very, very long time before he was governor. He's you know, attended executions of his clients. He's held his clients' hands as they were being, you know, executed. This is not he's not writing about this from a distance. He's writing about it, you know, really from up close and personal. And he talks about the fact that when he was governor, as much as he personally opposed the death penalty, he, you know, gave his word as an elected official that he would, you know, protect and defend the Constitution of Virginia, the Constitution of the United States, and uphold its laws. So he was very careful to not make the death penalty stronger while he was governor, and sentence enhancements that would lead to the death penalty. He would veto things like that, but he did have to follow the law as Virginia continued to carry out executions during those years. And he just writes this very thoughtful, very hopeful piece about how if a state like Virginia can abolish the death penalty, it is a model for other states to follow. I think at this point there are, I think it's 27 states and the federal government that still have the death penalty. And there's certainly hope that that Joe Biden will do something about that at the federal level, which will be a strong signal as well. But he basically writes about, it's really worth a read. He basically writes about how this should be the beginning for all of the other, a model for all of the other states to follow.
Yeah.
Can I tell you, when I read that story that you just described about him holding the hand of his client who was executed, it was one of the most moving things I've ever read. I just want to make one comment on this Virginia thing. This all happened, and in addition to that, strict new gun laws, broad LGBTQ protections, higher minimum wage, when the Democrats took over the legislature in Virginia there, with obviously the Democratic governor, who I think should have resigned years ago. He was the blackface guy, Northam. But if there's ever a time in American history where the Republicans stand for one thing, and if you like that, then vote for them, and the Democrats stand for another, and if you like that, vote for them, Virginia is sort of the object lesson. So that's a major moment. And by the way, they have executed more people than any other state. They've just been passed by Texas in recent history, but overall, Virginia is the are the champions of government executions of their people. We're talking to Andrea Cabral.
So, Andrea Cabral, after I read the New York Times long series about the former president's taxes, Jim, a year ago, something like that?
Last year.
It was a while ago. Saying that, you know, when he's trying to get a loan, he inflates the prices of his properties, and when he's trying to pay his taxes, he deflates the price of his properties, and other unusual tax methods. I couldn't believe it. Now, the Supreme Court, with three of his appointees on it, said he can't hide them anymore. They're going to the authorities, the district attorney in New York. So I'm thrilled.
I am, too. I mean, I always sort of think about the context of this and the fact that we have, as a country, we have forgotten more criminal and corrupt behavior by Donald Trump than we ever knew as a country for all of the 44 presidents before him.
That's a great
We've
point.
We've forgotten more that he's done. I mean, when you read this story about the fact that this is at the Supreme Court, and you read about the Supreme Court ruling, but, you know, you have to stop and take a breath and then hearken back to the fact that he was elected without ever having turned over his tax returns on the lie. We're at the, you know, we talk about the big lie about the election now. Well, there was a big lie at the beginning that he couldn't turn his tax returns over because they were under audit. It's always been a lie. The IRS said immediately that doesn't stop anybody from doing it. And in fact, Nixon did it. And he lied 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 about his tax returns and being willing to turn them over. And now here we are over 4 years later where he has fought tooth and nail. I mean, you talk about consciousness of guilt and you put that up against, you know, other presidents or other candidates, Hillary Clinton putting 30-something years of her tax returns online so people could see them on her website. He was always hiding crimes. From the beginning, he was hiding crimes. And, you know, he's managed to make it through 4 years of incredible damage to this country and now has to fend for himself as a private citizen. And the Supreme Court has, you know, failed to protect him in this 11th hour. But just, you know, think about what we could have been saved had he been forced to turn them over.
What do you mean we could have been saved? You mean like people wouldn't have voted for him?
I mean that if we had seen what I suspect strongly is in these tax records, and the New York Times, the one of the reasons we know who Mary Trump is because the New York Times did that sort of very deep dive into his tax records and the years and years and years of non-payment and fraud that are there. I mean, the idea of indicting a sitting president would have been a far more lively issue had it been about taxes.
You know, we
it
should
could be
clear
like
here.
Al Capone, you know, brought down by his taxes.
You know, just as far as I know, and add to this list if either of you have anything, we know there's a Georgia County prosecutor looking into the president's, a former president's behavior with Georgia officials in the vote. We know the state attorney general is looking into some business manipulation and possible serious civil violations. We know the Manhattan DA is looking at tax and insurance fraud, a crime in terms of these taxes. We know that there is a prosecutor in D.C. that just deposed little Don Jr. about the use of the inaugural funds. And we know that the prosecutor in Washington is also looking at whether or not the same behaviors for which the president was acquitted in the Senate should cause him to be indicted under federal law, which is almost the exact same language about rebellion and insurrection. I mean, there's going to be a torrent of litigation and potentially indictments against this guy. I mean, potentially imminently, Andrea. That's correct?
Well, I agree that certainly would seem to be the case, and that's what should happen. But what happened in the not stopping him sooner and not being really focused on that, and I mean, I'm talking from the very beginning. I'm talking about the emoluments. I remember being on your show, and we were at the library. I remember where we were, and I talked about him. They should start impeaching him now, and it was about the emoluments, and it was very early on. Because what he has met with all of the crimes that he committed upon entering office during the campaign, all of the campaign finance violations, and everything he did for the 4 years, the balance to that is that he was allowed to amass power and consolidate power, which he took with him out the door. Yeah. And you literally can see, based on what happened on January 6th, that he does command an incredibly violent group of people who continue to believe that the election was stolen and that he actually won. And as you see more and more, as more people are arrested and more people, there's more information that comes out about this very well-planned and you know, very highly networked insurrection or attempted coup, the depth of the belief of that, you know, where you've got people laying siege to the Capitol and saying to police officers, don't worry, you'll be able to keep your job. These people genuinely thought that they were there to overthrow government and that he would be installed as president again. And that was the big danger. It's all the other damage that he did in virtually every secretariat in the cabinet as well, but it was this commensurate raising of, you know, over $100 million of money, hundreds of millions actually in money he fundraised off of this, and he still commands a legion of incredibly violent people who believe this fantasy. And you know, that should never have been allowed to happen.
You know, and one of the things we also learned from these hearings is the likelihood that the reason the police did not respond initially with the vigor they should have was because the protesters and rioters were white. And it was a
right.
I mean,
right,
that was
and it
really...
was probably high level. You know, if the Pentagon is involved in not authorizing the sending of the National Guard, everybody kept wondering why. In the 11th hour, you know, after he fired Esper, why he started to install, you know, sycophants and toadies in places they were not at all qualified to be inside the Pentagon and in intelligence. It was because of this. It was because of what was coming on January 6th. And he wanted to make sure that the damage could be done without interference. I mean, I think, I don't know that if people have really grasped the enormity of this and just how close we came, but he's an incredibly dangerous person, and the level of danger he presents is commensurate with the level of power he's given, and he was given more power than anybody else really on the planet because he was the president of the United States, and he's not going to let that go.
You know, speaking of moving on, one of the great lines that I think really says it all is when that Congressman Ted Lieu said during the impeachment hearing, I think to a reporter during an interview, I'm not worried, or maybe on the floor of the Senate, I'm not sure where it was, I'm not worried about the president running for again and winning. I'm worried about the president running again, meaning Trump, and losing.
Yeah, that was a great,
which I thought
chilling.
Was chilling. It really,
yeah.
really
right.
was. We're He's talking
absolutely
to Andrea Cabral.
Right.
So, Andrea Cabral, I mean, the more things change, the more things don't seem to change at all. In this case in Rochester, New York, of Daniel Prude, he was handcuffed, had a hood put over his head, and slapped against the ground. The medical examiner called it a homicide caused by complications of asphyxia. Officials tried to hide the footage of what happened to him, and yet police officer is not going to face any charges.
Yeah, and the grand jury, this is an attorney general's grand jury, so this is Letitia James, who, you know, she didn't present before the grand jury, but it's the New York Attorney General's office that presented the case. You know, when I read through the story, the first thing I thought is I would want to know what charges were put before them and what the evidence is. Now, clearly grand jury testimony is, you know, secret, so I don't know that we're going to, if you're a witness, you can tell people what you testified to, but I don't know if we're going to know in any sort of really meaningful way what exactly was presented to the grand jury unless grand jurors talk about it themselves. I don't understand this. And while, you know, there were seven, I think, police officers involved at various points in this, and I think they were suspended. There were the officers that were on scene, and then there were superior officers, and then some, I think, involved in the in what, you know, was considered to be the cover-up of it thereafter. So they make the point that homicide a finding of homicide by the coroner is a medical distinction, not a legal one. And that's accurate. Homicide means death at the hands of another versus suicide at the hands of oneself, or misadventure, which would be, you know, an accident, falling off a cliff or something like that. But this is a person who was, their family called for help for him because he had mental health issues. He was, you know, erratic, certainly at the scene. He was naked. It was cold outside, and he wasn't wearing any clothes. Officers said that he was spitting, and they put what is this sort of hood over the head. It's a, it was a, I just know what color it was from watching the footage. It was a white hood over his head to keep him from spitting on them, but then kept him on the sidewalk and ultimately pinned him to the pavement, and he was naked. Now, it's a, clearly the family is calling for help for this person. This is a person who not only is unarmed, he is unclothed. And there's nothing that would have you have this person stand or put them in the back of a, yeah, of a cruiser at, with the doors that don't open because they're in the back seat. Now, they're making the distinction that he died of complications of asphyxia. He died a week later of complications of asphyxia. There was apparently PCP in his system, and that there was no trauma to or blockage of his airway during the incident. And that may be, I'm certain that contributed to, you know, the no bill on the indictment. But, I, you know, there are definitely ways to handle a situation like this.
Yep.
And what you can't help but be struck by is that virtually every single time someone calls for help, and especially if the individual is black, it ends in death. How could we possibly have any police department on the face of the earth, let alone a slew of them, time after time after time, month after month after month, who have no mechanism for dealing with a naked person in the throes of a mental crisis? You don't have to have, you know, a psychiatrist on scene. Would it be helpful if every police department had mental health professionals to respond to these things? Yes, but they don't. And if you can be trained to exert deadly force against someone, you certainly can be trained to help them in a way that causes them no harm.
Andrea, what happened to a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich kind of notion? I don't really understand the separation between Letitia James, who said she was the New York State Attorney General, who said she was, quote, disappointed by this. Now, I wasn't aware that it was her office that convened the grand jury. That would suggest, assuming that the ham sandwich thing is a truism, and you're a former prosecutor, so you would know that the prosecutors didn't press as hard as James is suggesting the evidence merited, doesn't it?
Well, I don't have any evidence of that, but that was precisely why I said my first reaction to it was, I want to know whether or not a single charge was presented before the grand jury, which limits their options, or if multiple charges related to the death, to the death of someone at the hands of another were presented. The range of manslaughter, second degree, first degree, were presented to the grand jury. I would want to know whether or not experts were presented. While you absolutely have the obligation to put exculpatory evidence before the grand jury, if one had, and there seem to be experts that are quoted in the Washington Post story as saying that the way that this individual was handled was not appropriate, pinning him to the pavement was not an appropriate way to handle that, I'd like to know what witnesses, you know, appeared before the grand jury to offer testimony on that issue. That's, I think, the devil is really in those details. I have no explanation for how this would, you would come away from this with absolutely no criminal charges at all, because I just don't see how you get to the point, how you get from alive and sitting on the sidewalk to dead on the pavement for someone who is unarmed and unclothed during this, and that there's nothing short of once he's on the ground, he's on the ground.
You know,
and there's, you know.
Yeah, we're short on time today. I hope we can continue this discussion next week because the world may have changed in regard to killings like this, too, because what remains is for the Department of Justice to decide, even though there's no state indictment here, that Daniel Prude's civil rights were violated. It's one thing under an Attorney General Barr, and it may be another thing under an Attorney General Garland. So maybe we can continue this discussion into our next one next week, Andrea, if it's
I would like that because – and we'll probably have an additional case to talk about. I hope not in that time, but it's likely.
Andrea, good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Good to talk to you.
Andrea
Bye-bye.
Cabral, thank you very much. Andrea Cabral joins us every week for Law & Order. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety, now CEO of Ascend. Coming up, Facebook takes a stand and sides with the pro-democracy movement in Myanmar. Tech writer Andy Anatko joins us to talk about that and more. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us to cover the latest headlines at the intersection of tech, policy, and commerce is Andy Anatko. Andy's a tech writer and blogger. You can find his work at anatko.com or follow him, follow him, at IHNATKO. Hello, Andy.
Hello there.
Hey.
Hey, Andy. Great to talk to you. So let's start with something I don't understand, and you're here to explain it to me. Apparently, we have a terrible a shortage of semiconductors, and we should be worried about it. Why do we have this shortage, and why should I be worried about it?
Yeah, well, see, everything we use has a CPU or a semiconductor or some kind of a microprocessor in it. And for the past few years, there are so few factories that are actually manufacturing them that they've been just barely keeping up with demand. And the past year, with all that's been going on, there's almost a little bit of a collapse of the factory's ability to supply all these manufacturers with what they need, so much so that the estimate is that demand is now outstripping supply by at least 30%, and it's going to be going on for at least for the next year before anybody can catch up. That means that certain products that are really hard to obtain, like the latest generation of the Sony PlayStation that was just released a few months ago, was in super short supply because they could not get the CPUs, the chips they needed to build them. Sony actually gave some guidance to analysts and investors recently, saying that they're not even sure that they're going to be up on supply by holiday purchasing season this year, let alone last year. And it's having big effects. So the car industry, Ford and GM, both have said that they've had to cut back in production and shut down certain production lines in plants all across America because they can't get their hands on the components that they need in order to keep cars coming out. This is a global sort of problem, and it's going to require a lot of effort in order to fix it.
So we've talked a lot about the Defense Production Act in the context of PPE and other COVID needs. If these microprocessors are so critical to so many things, I could live without the PlayStation, but I guess some kids can't, and some men obviously can't. But things that are much more important to our existence, why doesn't someone like Joe Biden invoke the Defense Production? I'm not kidding, by the way, the Defense Production Act to make sure that enough are manufactured, or at least we begin to catch up.
Partly because it's a global problem. It's also a problem that in the United States was created over many, many years of neglect. United States chip manufacturing companies, they still dominate the worldwide market. They sell about 47% of all the chips that are sold worldwide. However, long ago, they've been moving all their actual production to factories in Asia in just three different countries. And so now only about 12% how these products are actually manufactured inside the United States. So it would be nice if we could actually bring more of that product back here to the United States, but that's going to require many years of effort. Biden actually signed an executive order and had a bunch of meetings yesterday in which they did, just as you said, kind of establish this as not just a problem for the economy, but also as potentially a national security and defense problem. because it's not because this problem extends beyond just microprocessors. I mean, we can laugh about not, oh no, I'm going to have to deal with having a PlayStation 4 instead of a PlayStation 5. Oh the pain. Surely on this side of Jerusalem, none suffer as I suffer. But nonetheless, it's 80% of rare earth metals are imported from China that we use in this country, and those are used for like motors that go into generators, batteries, all kinds of different things. 90% of medical products that we use here in the United States also import from China, manufactured in China. So there is a defense, there is a national security or national issue in which we should be able to either bring that manufacturing back to the United States so that we can be independent, or we can establish alliances with South Korea and Japan and other countries and move that manufacturing outside of China. Yesterday he indicated that he's working with Congress to get $37 billion in funding. There was a bill for that was passed last year, passed by support of both parties, to increase domestic chip manufacturing capability. However, the funding for it was not in place. It had to be done through a future act of Congress. So he's trying to get that support for that $37 billion. But immediately he's initiated a 100-day-long review of the supply chain for four really, really important lines of things that we don't want to import quite so much of: semiconductors, rare earth minerals, also high capacity batteries like you'd find in electric cars, and pharmaceuticals, drugs. They've also going to do a year-long review of, in a more of a defense sort of posture, of six different chains of manufacturing sectors, including defense, public health, communications, technology, transportation, energy, and food production. Once again, not to make sure that, hey, we never need to import anything, but to make sure that we're not reliant on specifically China, but in generally at such a small part of the world for important resources. I will say that this problem has come up before, that we've had there have been times in technology where you could not buy RAM or you could not buy a hard drive you needed for your computer because there was a natural disaster that affected an area of Japan or an area of a country that was basically the one place where everybody was having their RAM or their storage manufactured. So we really can't let that happen.
So needless to say, I'll state the obvious. This issue alone gives China colossal bargaining power in any negotiation over anything with the United States, yeah, is it not?
Absolutely. I mean, they would have the ability to push around pretty much anybody in Asia, particularly, like, again, if they want to say, hey, Japan, if you want to continue to build to have a market for electric cars or for electric motors, guess what? You're going to need this raw material that only we can provide. One of the great things about their government is that they appreciate the ability, the importance of self-reliance, but also the ability to look far, far ahead. They have been spending an immense amount of money to Taiwan is the leading, the one country that has the leading production of microprocessors. China, as part of the trade war last year, they realized that, well, look, the fact that we are reliant on other countries for our microprocessors as well makes us sort of weak and reliant. We need to bring that capability inside China. So what have they been doing? They've been hiring thousands of Taiwanese executives and engineers in the chip fabrication industry, offering them triple pay, triple benefits to come and help them establish chip fabrication factories inside of China. So this is the sort of stuff that we're kind of stuck with. If we do nothing, they could, all that manufacturing capability that was in Taiwan could now be in China. They could be the ones who have 40% of the market. And now anytime that Apple wants to manufacture an iPhone, they're going to have to make sure that they are in good cahoots with China and that their government they're pressuring the United States government to make sure, please don't have a trade war with China. We've got the iPhone 15. It's the first one that you can put right on top of your eyeball. We're really excited about it, and we can't have a trade war right now.
Boy, it's going to keep prison labor really busy over there. We're talking to Andy Anatko.
So, Andy, apparently Facebook can do a lot of censoring if they want to do it. They just did it in Myanmar. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, Facebook's had a really, really bad situation with Myanmar for many years. The military, which even when it was quasi-democratically run, has always had the upper hand. Facebook first got into a lot of heat rightly so, with the world, when in 2018 Myanmar's military committed ethnic cleansing against its Muslim Rohingya minority population, and Facebook was being used as a platform by the military to spread violence, spread disinformation, spread hatred, basically grease the rails so that they could commit this act that the UN essentially cited as, no, this is absolutely ethnic cleansing. Since then, they did have realize their complicity in this human rights violation, and they have been eliminating accounts of military leaders, eliminating accounts and flagging them for, again, disruptive behavior, stuff like that. However, they did the military coup that happened on February 1st has sort of amplified what they feel as though they're required to do. Yesterday, they announced that they were actually shutting down accounts that are associated with basically every Myanmar government agency and office that's being controlled by the military, all companies and corporations that have been linked to military leaders and military operations. They no longer have access to messaging. They no longer have access to being able to buy ads and ad platforms. Facebook instituted a blog post which essentially cited the deadly violence and the need for that ban, the exceptionally severe human rights abuses, and also citing that, look, every time that we keep banning these people, they try to find a way of getting around it and regrouping under new accounts and new organizations. And for this reason, they feel as though they need to enforce this indefinite ban. And they're treating this as a very special ongoing emergency.
But so, doesn't Facebook act in all, whether it's elections here in the United States and misinformation and lies, or whether it's a military takeover in Myanmar, it's always after the damage has been done.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And then, you know, the Zuckerberg, literally or figuratively, can take credit for not allowing their platform to be used to have horrible things done. But the horrible things have been done and outcomes achieved already. Seems to me to be yet another argument for government, as soon as they figure out what Facebook does, to get more involved in, what was it, Orrin Hatch, who said, how do you make money, Mr. Zuckerberg?
Oh, God, that was so embarrassing.
We run ads, Senator. I mean, that's a fair, I mean, I assume you'd agree, it's often too little, too late, right?
I would agree with that. It is a huge problem for them to solve. However, they have an immense amount of resources in which to solve this sort of stuff. The one of the things that makes it difficult for a platform like Facebook and Instagram, and by the way, this does apply to Instagram as well, is that Facebook, it's a huge social network for us in the United States, but it is just one thing on the internet. In many countries that have just recently gotten access to the internet and this kind of technology, it kind of is the whole internet.
Yeah.
And so if you pull down it would seem as though it's time to pull Facebook down completely out of this country, since it's being used to create so many deaths and so much chaos. However, you also cut off the ability of activists to message with each other and coordinate with each other. Because even as the military has been shutting down the internet every single night, even as they've taken over the telecommunications companies and forced them to put bans on Facebook and Twitter, a lot of these organizers have used encryption systems and other systems to get around this sort of stuff, so that they can continue to have access not only to each other, but also to get their stories out of Myanmar and to the greater world. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the problem. But yes, you are right. I think that a lot of these companies, I don't have any love for Facebook whatsoever. I do think that they just absolutely don't get it, as opposed to what their responsibility is to the society that they operate in. Mm-hmm. However, this is also not a role that these companies are very much used to. They're not used to being a munitions manufacturer. They're used to being an ad platform. So sometimes it is that they're very, very slow to really get that. Hey, look, here is what was possible on January 6th in the United States of America because of Twitter, because you let this president say whatever the hell he wanted for so many years. Mm-hmm. Now you get that this is what you, again, you're in a very real way, you are a munitions factory in addition to being a social network.
So Andy Anatko, I have a friend, I don't want to mention his or her name. I have a friend who has some issues with executive functioning, you know, sort of being organized. I'll just give you one example. Again, I'm not going to mention his or her. Marjorie, can I finish my thought here, if you don't mind? I'm not going to mention his or her name, but just as one example.
Being the operative word.
One example. There was a local election in her town a couple of years ago. And she went to vote, which I think is, I assume you'd agree, is a civic responsibility, and I commend her for that. There were two small problems. Mm-hmm. One, she went to the wrong location. And that wasn't that big of a problem. But when it turned out she figured out what the right location was, it turns out she also went on the wrong day. So is there anything out there
who would do such a thing
in terms of organizing one's actions that might help a person like that? Do you know of any such of any such thing?
I think he does.
Do you?
Well, the first thing is I would say that to this person, if they are within the sound of my voice, you're in a place of peace and love, and nothing can happen within this space of peace and love that you do not want to happen. We are
That's
here.
Beautiful.
Not
to... So true.
Thank you.
We're not here to judge. It's true.
No,
go ahead.
I'm exactly the same way. I'm really pleased with an online tool, information tool that I just found called Workflowy. It's a terrible, terrible name, Work. Followed by the word flowy.
I like it.
It's like the Smuckers of tech words. I hate it. But I love it. I love the way it works. It's a web app. So any computer you have that has access to the web, a web browser will work with it. And I kind of want the thing that people will be most familiar with is the concept of an outliner. You know, where you type something in and then you create a list. They can create subheads underneath that list. However, they've done something I can't really put my finger on, where they've both simplified it so that to make it more abstract, but also retain the power of having this data structure where you don't know how to organize this information, but you know what all these little bits of information are. So, like, when here's the name of my pain. My pain right now is not voting, of course. It is actually the fact that I've been in lockdown for about a year. I've started a million projects around the house, and I don't know which needs to be finished. Where the door to my second bedroom is right now? Because but with all this stuff, like with my brain, it's too much to really manage. And so, just by testing out Workflow, it's been out for 10 years. I just found it just a few weeks ago, unfortunately. Let's start off by making a list of every room and area in the house. Okay, so now a list of like 8 things. Like, okay, now we're just going to talk about the bathroom on the first floor. I said, oh, okay, well, the faucet, I need to replace the faucet because it's kind of rusty. Oh, and also, I've got some laundry kind of piled up in the shower that's been there for 4 days. I need to get rid of that. Also, I need, and then going room by room by room, now I have not even, it's not a to-do list. It's not a Pomodoro, like, categories and outcomes and whatever. It's just a list of things that I've been able to manage and massage and make some shape into that now makes me able to create this project or write, in some cases, write this article I need to write or write the script I need to write. The problem with so many of these other tools that I've found is that it wants to evangelize you, you know? It says, now, first of all, you have to learn French. Now, you have to learn this mountain dialect. Now, let me finish. This mountain dialect of French, it was created by French dairy people who've been productive for 800 years. Now, you start with colors, like, but I don't – all I want to do is figure out, like, I want to get to a point where I can fix the faucet in the bathroom. I've seen some of the greatest minds of my generation burned out by, okay, let me tell you about this app called Notion. Now, here, if you watch this 8-hour video, like, I don't want to, I'm not going to be productive. I don't want to learn how to use this thing. I want to be more productive in the real world.
I want you to be concrete about this because I think this could be, I'm not joking, huge value to all of us. Tell us the form you would enter that information about all the stuff you wanted to do in your house this year, and then what Workflowy does to make it more organized and manageable.
It's just a simple list where you type something in and you get a bullet, and you hit return and you get another list item with a bullet. Or maybe you want to double click on one of these things to sort of zoom in on that thing. And then you can just, if you want to write like a whole like three paragraph spiel under this, suddenly this thing you've double clicked on looks like a document because it fills out the entire window. But when you click the back button, now you're back to just one little line in this list that you've built. And you can have multiple lists with multiple formats. It's so simple that it's like clay. It becomes whatever you want it to become, and it doesn't impose any rules upon you, which is how you get your brain to sort of figure out its own solutions.
So a couple of things. One, you're making it sound like it's very user-friendly. Is that a safe assumption?
It's one of the simplest web apps I've ever seen. It's connected to the cloud, so it'll work wherever you go.
And is it free?
There's a free version of it that lets you do, I think, 250 lists per month. I kind of want them to keep going, so I was very, very happy to give them $5 a month. I actually signed up for the annual thing, which it's only $50.
You have more than 250 lists? Always,
yeah.
That's a lot of lists.
I suppose I could. I want them to make money so that they keep this thing running. Which the thing you get worried about is when you're like, wow, this is a great tool that they're not charging me any money for. What is their game? If they're charging me money, I figure, okay, great. They're paying their programmers. This is how they're making money by actually charging me money for it. So, like I said, it's very, very simple. It's if you're a scattered brain, it lets you take all that stuff, those D's that are inside your skull, take them out, put them in little rows, and move them around until you understand what they're trying to tell you.
So, Workflowy, WorkFlowy. I am really trying this thing right after the show.
I'm trying,
Marjorie,
it too.
If you can remember the name of it, you will try it at the end of the show.
You know,
too.
We have some very loyal listeners here, Jim. I just got an email from Paul.
Yeah.
Who just warns me that I should stay away from any list kind of functioning thing that requires one to wear earbuds, which, of course, he recalls that I lost in the mulch.
On your first day. They
on
were
89.7
earbuds that were disappeared on day one. Andy, that was great. It's good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Hey, Andy, that was great.
Thanks,
thank you. I'm all excited about this Workflowy tool. It's supposed to supercharge your brain, Jim. The best tool for deep thought and work organization ever.
You know, in all seriousness, I'm doing this this afternoon. I'm
Me
really
too.
Psyched. I'm going to check it out this afternoon.
Workflowy.
Yep.
Okay. Andy Inocco joins us regularly. He's a tech writer and blogger. You can find his work at Inocco.com and follow him at Inocco. That is I-H-N as in Nancy, A-T-K-O. Coming up, for nearly a year, students have been learning under duress. We're going to talk to Paul about what we talked about a little earlier with listeners. Should the state have a test to gauge how much learning students have lost? And what about the state's requirement, the governor's requirement, and the Commission of Education's requirement to get at least the elementary schools started really soon. Paul Revel joins us for that up next.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Join us online to talk about all the ways coronavirus is putting a huge strain on our education infrastructure and what the long-term consequences could be for teachers, students, parents, as Paul Revel. Paul's the former state secretary of education, professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Elaine Weiss, Broader, Bolder, Better, How Schools and Communities Help Students Overcome the Disadvantages of Poverty. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Jim and Marjorie. Good to be with you.
You
great
too.
Great to talk to you, Paul. Good you weren't here earlier because Jim and I were in our usual fight about teachers.
No, it was
unions.
Okay. It was okay.
It was okay. But anyway, the Baker administration, as you know, and his education secretary, Jeff Riley, basically want to force school districts to reopen for kids, little kids, 5 days a week, and high schools, older kids to follow. Should you be doing this?
Well, I think the motivation and the statistic they're citing on particularly the children's mental health issues is really compelling when you take a look at, the number of cries for help that are coming in and being unmet by the mental health system, and many of which were being met in some way, shape, or form by school, or by virtue of being in schools, kids had fewer problems. So I think there's compelling evidence. I know a number of the superintendents around the state have been very eager for the state to take a more directive role, and were asking for this some months ago and didn't get it. This came, I think, as a bit of a surprise to the field all at once. it is not a set mandate. In other words, the governor has not done something he could do, which is declare emergency powers and mandate and require local districts to do it. It's something that's going to require an action from the Board of Education. And if they take this action, then the department is going to reclassify remote learning as it affects the number of hours that students have to spend in school in order for it to be considered a school day. So they're using kind of an indirect route to putting pressure on districts to do it, and they've indicated they'll give them a waiver. And so we'll see how it plays out. It's naturally going to generate a great deal of resistance from the unions because the districts, in the absence of clear state leadership on this in the past, have gone ahead and negotiated arrangements with unions that this particular mandate will violate in some instances. So it's complicated by virtue of having done it this late. I mean, the state basically said anything goes, you do what you want at a local level. And now they're being more directive in the middle of a school year. And so it's going to be very messy, but I do think it's the right direction to go. I think we need to start pushing harder to bring kids back. The numbers are going down. The knowledge about safety and distancing and testing and so forth has gone up. I think it can be done safely, but it's going to be complicated and controversial.
You know, one of the things I don't understand, as I said to Marty, I interviewed last night on television the president of the Mass Teachers Association, the president of the Boston Teachers Union, and they both, their primary concern, not primary, their initial concern before some of their concerns on the merits, from their perspective, was that they found out about it when the announcements were made. And I have to say, I can only speak for myself, but I'm guessing I speak for everybody listening. The surest way to make sure that I don't agree with whatever you have to say that affects my life is to not tell me you're going to order me to do something before you include me. In Boston, the city and the union were able to cut a deal that got schools on some levels opened in January because they sat down and negotiated. And even if they couldn't end up cutting a deal with the statewide unions, would you have ever, when you were the Secretary of Education, would you have ever allowed your Commissioner of Education to have unilaterally announced a precedent-setting move, meaning overruling local, forget the unions, local school committees, without at least consulting, even if you chose to ignore their advice, consulting the people most affected?
No, I mean, Jim, you make a point that I couldn't possibly disagree with about, you know, the fundamental rule of politics in this kind of space is no surprises.
Exactly.
And however, I have to say that this, and I don't have inside knowledge on this. But
I don't either.
Just reading it as an outsider, it looks to me like this was a situation where something was leaked to the media before the commissioner, who has a reputation for being very good about exactly what you're talking about, reaching out to people, mm-hmm. consulting with people. He's certainly been doing the consulting all along on what they ought to do. And he's been an advocate for reopening for a long time and wanted the state to take a stronger role. It feels to me like something got out ahead of them before he had a chance to pick up the phone and talk to people about it. But I agree with you. The element of surprise is bound to make a challenging problem even more challenging.
And, you know, once again, I would argue that talking about the element of surprise in the middle of what is basically a tragedy and a pandemic like nothing we've ever experienced before is a little petty. I mean,
no, Marjorie, as someone who's been involved in a lot of negotiations, mm-hmm. when I ran a union, there's actually a possibility that just like the Boston Teachers Union, which is a pretty tough union, cut a deal with the city, that maybe they could have cut a deal rather than having to be faced with opposition, which may cause what you and Paul and maybe me think is a good idea, reopening schools by edict in April, to be resisted by the unions. Maybe they could have arranged something.
Guess who else found out with no notice?
Who?
All these mothers and fathers who are trying to plan their lives.
Yeah, but
you know?
Excuse me, they don't have an organization. The 175,000 educators mm-hmm. do have organizations. Sit down with them and see if you can do something. And by the way, if you don't, you're the boss, you're the state, you have the power to seek whatever authority you want, but you're basically saying, I'm going to almost guarantee resistance. rather than take an opportunity to maybe not have resistance again, like we didn't have once. Remember, but well, one last thing, for those who think this is unrealistic, one last thing. It was in December that the same Boston Teachers Union passed a no confidence resolution in the superintendent. And a month later, they cut a deal with the superintendent and the mayor.
But again, do you think it was helpful for the head of the MTA to call Riley, talk about his arrogance, or for the head of the AF, the American Federation of Teachers, to talk about the failed vaccine rollout in Massachusetts by Governor Baker? Yeah, you could say it is a failed vaccine rollout, but that isn't really helping your side. So I guess it's both sides, Jim. I would see here
well,
both sides.
Well, again, when you're the decision maker, which the state is, I would argue it's incumbent on you to try to get everybody to the table. One last thing about this, Paul, if I may. As someone who's run the education infrastructure in Massachusetts, would you be worried if you were a local school committee where local control has sort of been the hallmark of how public education, K through 12, runs in the state, that this is a slippery slope? Or would you say this is an emergency, and even if we don't like it, it's a one-and-done kind of action by the state?
Well, I think just to the former point, I think you're right about the, adding insult to injury with making it a surprise was unfortunate, but I don't know if it was deliberate.
I don't know either.
And furthermore, the parties had been negotiating for some time about this, and the union's position, for example, is quite clear that under no circumstances would they have supported this. That's coming forward. So Marjorie has a point there as well. I think on the local control point, I think the governor's been extraordinarily deferential to local control. I would argue overly deferential. In other words, something like this could have happened much earlier in this academic year had he been willing to declare emergency powers, which he didn't even do in this circumstance. This is a sort of a backdoor in certain respects, as it's going to go to hourly requirements and regulations about the length of the school day and things of that nature. And it's got plenty of opportunity for waivers to allow local communities to declare extraordinary situations. So I don't think this is – I think we're in a state that, sort of lives and dies by the notion of local control. So I wouldn't be worried about that.
So – But Paul Bravo, let's ask you about another controversial thing, whether or not there should be MCAS testing, standardized testing to see where kids are and their learning deficits. I think the Globe editorial is a great point where it says we don't need to talk about them in terms of graduation or that kind of thing this year, but we do need to use them to assess how much learning these kids have lost. This is also controversial. The union leaders don't want that either. What should they do about the MCAS?
Well, I think the state has struck the right sort of middle course on this right now. To me, it's a civil rights issue, as it's always been, to measure the degree to which children are learning and making progress. And if we don't measure, we don't know. And if we don't know, we can't do anything about issues like racial equity or social justice. So we've got to do a diagnostic. This is tantamount, in my mind, to having a patient come into a doctor's office and say, well, I'm not going to do any tests on you because it will be inconvenient or uncomfortable. We'll just make a best guess about where you are. So I think you got to do some modest testing. These guidelines call for the reduction of testing. You can do it remotely. You can do it in person. You can do it late in the academic year. It doesn't have to be all at the same time. It could be done in the summer. It could even be done next fall. And there shouldn't be consequences. States don't have to attach any consequences in terms of school identification or accountability to them. So I think it's a reasonable and responsible way. We're going to have such wide distribution of student progress, from zero progress or going backwards to kids who are keeping pace or even doing better given all the enrichment they've had. Teachers and schools have got to know this. Now, teachers have their own ways of judging this and the work that they do with students in a classroom basis. But overall, as a system, as a school system, as a commonwealth, we've got to have something of a read for equity purposes and for diagnostic purposes to know where students are so we can meet them where they are and give them what they need.
You know, Paul, by the way, it's true there wouldn't even be an MCAS had there not been you, right? I mean, you it was your reform.
Well,
that,
I mean, that is true, though. I was part of a big team.
Yeah, I meant that as an attack. Yeah, sure. I didn't mean that as an embrace. No, I'm kidding. I was never crazy about MCAS, but I agree here.
Of course
not. I don't know how you measure learning loss in this environment. What do you think is the long-term prospect for these standardized testing things? Are they going to survive or no?
I think some of our friends in the union are hoping that this crisis is an opportunity to clear them off the board altogether, and they're disappointed, and they're going to howl about that as well. But I think I think there's a strong sort of common sense element in the business community and society more generally that we can't pursue any enterprise, whether it's medicine or business, without having goals and measuring progress. Mm. And how we choose to hold people accountable, that's where the rubber hits the road. And I think some adaptations and changes could be made. I am not an advocate for simply doing MCAS the way we first got it started in the 1990s. I think there are ways in which we could be smarter and do better with assessment, but we have to do some statewide assessment to measure the progress of school districts in how they're spending taxpayers' money to advance student learning. And for student purposes, when we have in Massachusetts, while we boast about our averages, we have some of the steepest achievement gaps in the nation between subgroups. So to propose not measuring subgroup performance seems to me to abandon our responsibility from a civil rights perspective to do better by those children who we've been least well serving, who often happen to be low income, Black and brown, English language learners, or students with disabilities. So we want to just say, hey, don't worry about it. We'll do the best we can. That's the world we had before. And those kids were losing out then. They're losing out even more in this crisis. Mm-hmm. We've got to pay attention to them, which means finding out, meet them where they are, give them what they need, and using some tools of assessment to get there, I think, makes as much sense as it does to take a patient's temperature if you're a doctor.
So Paul Revel, our education lawmakers and education advocates are talking about basically funding early childhood education like we fund K through 12 education. It would cost a fortune. But on the other hand, in this story by Stephanie Ebert in The Globe, it points out that the average infant daycare is $21,000 a year in Massachusetts. To me, this is something Elizabeth Warren talked about in her brief run for president, when she was saying that families should not have to spend more than 7% of their income on child care, which winds up being more than your rent and more than your mortgage in most families. So anyway, I will shut up. Is there any chance that this could happen, that we could actually publicly fund early ed?
Well, it's very ambitious from a financial standpoint. It makes all kinds of sense from an educational standpoint, child development standpoint. You know, we've known that the yield on investing in early childhood is a return on investment of sort of 7 to 1 for each dollar invested. And it's something that most other advanced industrialized nations do as a matter of course. They're just totally convinced that investing in the front end is the best way to guarantee future success for young people in education, to keep down special education costs and to keep children advancing. So there's no question that it's a good investment to make. You know, in the midst of this crisis and at the same time taking into account we may have some other federal funds coming in and so forth that would help us get something like this started, it's going to be complicated from a financing standpoint, but I think there are some good ideas in there about how it might be financed over time. I can't think of a better investment in our sector. You know, I often say if there were just one thing you could do in education and you had a limited amount of money, it would be that investment in early childhood education.
Well,
I think it's in the right direction.
You know what kind of surprised me is the support for this from the business community. So does this mean the tide is somehow turning on the idea that with so many women in the workforce, too, especially women with young children, that this is part of what we need?
I think the women in the workforce issue has reinvigorated a longstanding business community interest in this. I mean, the Mass Business Roundtable, for example, has been a leader on this. J.D. Chesloff was chair of the board of early childhood education in our administration. So the business community, I mean, the Federal Reserve Bank out in Minnesota had done many of the early studies on the value of, and importance of early childhood. So the business community has been there. I think it's even more attractive to them now because the K-12 sector has gotten so divisive over charter schools and testing and everything else. And they're convinced by the return on investment. And now in the midst of this crisis and more women withdrawing from the workforce and a desire to get more diversity in their workforce, I think they're back and it's very exciting. Our former early education commissioner, Tom Weber, is working very hard on this issue in this coalition. And I think it's really much to our advantage as a Commonwealth that the business community is starting to take a deeper interest in education. Mass Business Alliance has been doing a lot of work on this set of issues as well. So very exciting, I think.
Can I just add one note to this, though? And I'll try to control myself. When one of the lead sponsors of this in the Globe story is quoted as, how do you fund it? He said, well, you know, the millionaire's tax could be back on the ballot, the one that was on its way to the ballot, and then on a technicality with the Supreme Judicial Court ruled that it couldn't go on the ballot. Well, they fixed it. Theoretically, it's going to, which would raise a couple of billion dollars a year, half to go to transportation, half to education. What is appalling to me about that comment, and he is not alone on this, is if it's so important, as the three of us agree, and I assume the vast majority of legislators agree, that this early education happen and it be universal, rather than being cowardly and saying, let's hope that the voters have the courage that we don't and vote to increase taxes so that we can fund this thing, why don't they come up with a funding mechanism that they could vote on tomorrow, rather than crossing their fingers for November of 2022 and let them fund the damn proposal if it's so important for the future of the Commonwealth, you know?
Jim Browdy, you could have saved the Commonwealth had you prevailed in your graduated income tax crusade from a few years ago.
Well, I could have, but I only lost...
wouldn't be...
Well, in all fairness, we only lost 71% to 29%.
But I mean, that would change everything, wouldn't
it? Fine.
Yeah.
But in any case, my...
A squeaker.
Excuse me, I didn't need your help on that, Paul. I think I covered it by myself.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
But I'm serious. This is so important and so obviously necessary, both in terms of the kid, not to mention the financial strain on the family, this 21 grand that Marjorie mentioned, that if it's so important, then raise the damn money by voting yourself for this thing. We got to go, but that's my two cents.
Okay,
Paul,
to be continued.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the nature of politics, unfortunately. But hopefully, they'll find a way to get one way or another the resources necessary to do something that ought to be a top priority.
Thanks, Paul. Good to talk to you. Be well.
Paul Revel joins us on a regular basis. He's the former Secretary of Education, professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, which addresses a lot of these issues, co-author with Lane Weiss, Broader, Bolder, Better, How Schools and the Communities Help Students Overcome the Disadvantages of Poverty. Coming up, we're going to be joined by Jared Bowen, WGBH arts editor, for the latest in arts and movies about town.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us for the latest rundown of arts and culture events in and around town and around your sofa, if you choose, is GBH's executive arts editor, Jared Bowen. He's host of the TV series Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights at 8:30 right here on GBH2. Hey there, Jared. How are you?
It's great to be with you, both.
And you too.
Well, Jared, before we get into the arts world, the whole state is in a frenzy with the vaccine situation. I understand you are still struggling. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, so here's the update. So I last was on with you both, and I was saying how frustrating it was over the last few weeks. I feel like I've come to master how you book appointments at Gillette. I figured rather than try to master the whole system, because I'm trying to help family members and friends who, you know, just like my father, whom I described, can't access with a laptop. So let me figure out how to do Gillette. I'll do that well. I have for the last few weeks been able to book appointments, and then it all changed this morning. And frankly, I spent several hours this morning getting bounced around. This waiting room that was introduced, I don't think is necessarily working. You go from your waiting 20 minutes to, and I'm not exaggerating here, your wait time is 1,393 minutes.
No, wait a second. I was trying to help a friend. I got to 2,742 minutes. I beat you, actually.
2,742 minutes. Oh, my God.
Which, let me do the math for you. That's 23 and, you know, a little bit in exchange hours. So just put on the diaper, order in the takeout, and get ready to wait your 1,393 minutes. I mean, this is just so frustrating. And then you get through, as I did at several points, and you're told there are a few appointments here, a few appointments there. You try to book them. It tells you the appointment is not actually available, and then you're bounced back to, you know, Jim's waiting 300,000 minutes again. I mean, it's just...
I think I got angry
and emotional last time. Now it's just epically frustrating. And I think there was no anticipation, at least on my part, that when the announcements came that the website was going to be overhauled and it would be much easier and much more efficient today, that that would actually happen. And it hasn't. Mm. You know, you wonder why the state doesn't call Alabama or West Virginia or other states that have managed to do it well and have the same system here.
Yeah, I got a relative an appointment in Alabama, actually, this morning. So that's...
So it's still epically frustrating to get your appointments, but I did score an appointment finally for my father.
Good.
And I took him to Gillette. And can I just tell you that CIC does the most extraordinary job managing this. You basically walk into Gillette Stadium, and it's so efficient to just drive there, park easily. They have a giant jumbotron, which tells you what time, which appointments they're accepting. You walk in, and it's almost like walking on a conveyor belt because you really don't stop. They make it so smooth, so efficient, so safe, so friendly that my father, who I think you may have gotten a sense of his personality based on our last conversation, said it was fun. You know, it's a little uncharacteristic of him. He really enjoyed the experience because I think because the beginning was so fraught to finally have it administered with such capability is just wonderful to embrace.
Well, actually, I can understand why you said living is fun. I found it to be.
Right,
and
exactly.
That is pretty much what you get. So we're really glad it's working out, but I totally get the frustration. We're talking to Jared Bowen, a vaccinator extraordinaire.
Well, Jared, I know you've already been there because you reported on the Emerald Necklace lights, but maybe the thing to do after work today is go back and you could calm down a little bit. Tell people exactly what the Emerald Necklace Conservancy is doing.
Do they have Wi-Fi hotspots in the Emerald Necklace Conservancy so I can bring my laptop and, you know, try to get these appointments finally and book everybody around me? What they're doing is something that I think will indeed bring at least my blood pressure down, which is they're illuminating bridges in the Emerald Necklace. I've talked about them before and how they incorporate art into the park and just these different manifestations that make you go into a space that you think you already know but see it in a different light, especially a few years ago when they had the fog sculptures there.
Yeah.
And so that's what they're doing with a number of bridges that you can find on their emeraldnecklace.org website. But I think it's a really striking way to light up the park, to light up this really bleak time of the year, although the weather is changing, so it's more comfortable to be out and walking about. But you see these battery-powered LED lights just lighting up the park. And as I say, this is the joy for me, is to always introduce some other artistic element that can make you experience something you already thought you knew in a really different way. Or if you've never been, it's a great magnet to finally explore.
Let me just say one thing about I haven't been there because obviously I don't go out of the house. So if you don't go to the house, you can't go there. But I went to emeraldnecklace.org/necklacelights.
The pictures.
It is so incredibly beautiful. I am actually going to go in the next couple of nights. It's from dusk to, I guess, 9 p.m., and they've just done a beautiful thing at a perfect time, and good for them. It is truly, truly beautiful. So,
well, Jared, here's another beautiful thing, which you already featured on Open Studio, but tell us about this David Sibley exhibition.
Yeah, this is great. So a lot of people might recognize the name David Sibley as our preeminent birder in these times and the myriad books that he's produced. What people might not realize is that the books that David Sibley has produced, he's also done the illustrations. He has been a birder since the age of 5. His father was an ornithologist. He has been drawing and painting since the age of 5. And so what's happened now is the Museum of American Bird Art at Mass Audubon which is in Canton, on this beautiful preserve, wildlife preserve. They've created an exhibition called What It's Like to Be a Bird, Paintings by David Sibley. And these are his original illustrations for his most recent book. And what's fun here is that typically David Sibley, I spoke to him for Open Studio, and typically he feels constrained in that he has to depict a bird just as it is because it's a guidebook. But in his new book, What It's Like to Be a Bird, he can give some more personality. So you see birds eating, swimming, flying, fishing, and they're all double life size because that's how he paints, and until they shrink them down. But you really get a sense of his detail and how he captures the world.
You know, by the way, I'm not that into birds. I mean, if I see a beautiful bird, I love it. But his stuff
is amazing. Yeah.
But I want you to know, Margie, did you watch the Open Studio segment?
I certainly did.
Okay, so I want to, you know, anybody who thinks that Jared is not a crack interviewer, let me give you an example of how this starts. So Jared and Sibley are out in the woods. So
they're
who the hell knows where? Who the hell?
Jared's got a beautiful parka on.
Asked the question that I think we all wanted to hear. So David, I'm going to do it as best as reenactment as I can. David, what exactly, when you come into the woods, what exactly is your process? To which David Allen Sibley says, I look for birds. And so...
Look, you know, I didn't ask him if you were a tree, what kind of a tree would you be? At least I didn't do that.
He literally says, I love that. He says, I'll look for birds. Just totally. You know what the other thing that I thought was amazing in your interview, which was great, by the way, is it bluebirds or blue jays that are not actually blue?
Who knew
Isn't that interesting?
Could you explain that as best you can?
Well, I'll distill it down. David Sibley can explain it so much better. But it's basically birds aren't actually blue. It's how we see the sunlight that goes essentially through their feathers and through the bones. It's basically all about how the light is refracted is how we human beings see blue. But that's not actually the case. In birds, it doesn't actually exist in nature technically. He can explain it much, much better. I'm not a scientist, obviously.
It was great. It was a great interview. And I, by the way, I want to be clear. You can't quarrel if you're going to paint birds. You got to look for birds. So I think
there's no question about that, Jim.
That would have been
but
my process if I could do it too.
I mean, the paintings, as you said, Jared, are just incredible. I mean, the talent. I mean, the detail. The blue jay. When we learn that the blue jay isn't really blue, I mean, it's worth seeing that. Where is this place, by the way, the Museum of American Bird Art?
It's in Canton. Place. They have a great – they're the only museum of its kind, by the way, and they have a great collection of all of these terrific artists, Audubon, of course, and Andy Warhol, who've depicted birds over the years. It's really extraordinary. And the last thing I'll say, Marjorie, you just reminded me why I think they're so striking is you look at these birds, you look at their eyes. David Sibley does so much with personality and the sense of the bird just through his depiction of their eyes.
Well, his painting of the gray jay is one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen. In any case, that was a joke, Marjorie. Thank you.
Yeah, so, I thought I missed something. The gray jay?
Blue jay, gray jay, you know, it's not
no,
all
I like
blue.
The poor.
Yeah, I wasn't following either.
Thank you.
He makes a great point about how angry the hawks look because of their eyes, right?
Yeah. Yep.
They need Botox or something.
So can we I'm dying to hear your assessment of Frances McDormand's latest, because either tonight or tomorrow night, I'm going to watch his Nomadland. Let's play a little clip, and then, Jared, you'll give us your sense of the film. Here it is.
I just looked up the value on your van. With that high a mileage, you're looking about $5,000 at the most.
I'd probably recommend taking that money and putting it towards a different vehicle.
I can't do that. I can't do that, see, because, all right, I spent a lot of time and money building the inside out, and a lot of people don't understand the value of that, but it's not something like we can, I live in there, it's my home.
I live in there. It's my home. Tell us about it, Jared.
Quite simply put, it's just an excellent, excellent film. I think it's a perfect performance by Frances McDormand. So she plays a woman who has essentially kind of lost her whole existence. She's lost her husband. The mining town in which she worked went bust. So this is set in Nevada. The zip code was canceled because everybody essentially had to move out. There were just no jobs left. This is based in reality. It's based off of a book. But left with nothing, she takes to her van and she starts traveling around and connects with other nomad communities, mostly out in the West in the Dakotas, Nevada, and it's just a film about experiencing life for its purity, but also here, as we realize with her character, it's out of necessity. She takes odd jobs. At one point, we find her working in an Amazon distribution facility, and there's a woman there who is explaining her tattoo, which says, home is something you carry with you, not a physical place. And I think that just sets the tone for the entire film. And the way this is shot is Frances McDormand really did travel around in this van. There are actual nomads who turned actors for the film, so there's this great sense of reality. Frances McDormand is one of just a few actors that I will see whatever she's in, no matter what it is. It could get the worst reviews. It could look like the most absurd film, but just because she's in it, I'll watch it. And this is a classic example because she just disappears into this character. It's so rare that I think you can feel what a character is feeling rather than having the character show you what you're supposed to feel. But that's how it happens here.
She's great. She is really. What was that incredibly depressing thing she did a couple of years ago? It was a three or four part thing on television. I think.
Olive Kittredge on HBO.
Oh my god.
But you know something? But that's a great book. It is a great book, and I think it won the Pulitzer Prize, didn't it? Olive Kittredge a few years back. Yeah, it wasn't
She's
upbeat,
brilliant.
But about a mother in Maine and this woman in Maine. It was really something. So we spoke. By the way, it's on Netflix, is it?
This is on Hulu.
Hulu.
Okay, so you have to get Hulu to watch it.
You can get a package, though, Marjorie. Hulu's part of a package if you, check it out. Save a few bucks. Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about Minari. We spoke about this yesterday, but tell us about it again.
Bob Thompson, yeah. What's your sense?
Oh, you're cheating around on me with
we are totally into this film, too, only from the description. But go ahead.
This, I think, is also, I mean, really, Nomadland and for at least the films I've seen so far, and Minari are I think, the two of the best films of the year. This is also the sense of home and what it means to be in this country. But here it comes to a very different prism. We find this Korean-American family who's moving from California to Arkansas because the dad wants
to... Yeah, I do that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, he wants to... And I think we're seeing a lot of this happen, actually. We're seeing people leave more congested areas and cities and urban areas because they suddenly realize that they want to find some sort of connection to the land, or they just want to feel safer during a pandemic and have more room. But we find this family in the 1980s moving to Arkansas. The father wants to establish a farm. It is going to be their Garden of Eden, but there is a divide between the mother and father here. They have two young kids. One of them is ill, and so the mother is concerned about him. So they send for their grandmother, who arrives. And she really can't cook or bake or anything, but she plays cards really well. And so she establishes this really charming bond with their son. But it's the story about assimilation and what it means to be in this country and what it means to build in this country and work your way forward when you have so many setbacks. And it's just like Nomadland, it's very elegantly told. There aren't these big, huge, major set pieces or plot pieces that kind of blow up and distract your attention. It just moves along.
Have you thought, Marjorie, I mean, I know you like doing, you know, flower arrangements through your yard. Have you thought of returning to the land and moving to Arkansas? No, we haven't talked much lately because I don't see you anymore, Have you thought of that?
I'm a city person, Jim. I like to be with neighbors, a few feet away on either side and upstairs and downstairs.
Okay, I was checking.
How about you, Jim? I know you're kind of a cowboy side,
too. I actually own
a
vacation home in Arkansas, and I'm thinking of...
That is not. You've been watching Ozark too much, I think. That's Jason Bateman who bought the home there.
That is
you.
One of the scary... Well, that's Missouri, I think, something. But whatever it is, it's frightening. So anytime we have an opportunity to talk about something which a major piece of was done, that's horrible English, at GBH, I am all in. Boston Lyric Opera, what's going on with this Fall of the House of Usher thing? Also one of my favorite stories, I should say, by the way. But go ahead.
Well, Boston Lyric Opera has made a film. Just like everybody else, they're trying to figure out how to keep the company moving forward. Obviously, they would traditionally be staging operas. Actually, tradition isn't the great word for them because they, as we have talked about over the years, they don't have a permanent home anymore. So they move everywhere from staging pieces at the Cyclorama in Boston to the ice rink in the North End. And so they're continuing this period of exploration by making a film. And they had been slated to produce The Fall of the House of Usher based on the Edgar Allan Poe story, music by Philip Glass. Couldn't do that. So they turned to James Darrow, who's a young filmmaker who and opera lover who has married the two. The Fall of the House of Usher is a very Boston story, actually. Poe was based here, and yep. Rumor has it that he got the inspiration for this story about two dead bodies that were found not too far away from where we're all sitting, actually, in downtown Boston in a home. So it's a story about this brother and sister. But James Darrow sets it in the present day as he's worked with his screenwriter to update this. And so we're really looking at it through the prism of this young girl who is her name is Luna. She's held at a detention center. And this story is kind of manifested through her own eyes, but they're telling through different vocabulary. So it's stop motion animation as we get a sense of her life. But there's also real life video, vintage video that's incorporated. And then animation, and then all to Philip Glass's music. It works well for film because there are whole passages without actual singing. So Philip Glass gives us this tone, this feeling, which James Darrow then gives us the visuals to.
What was done here at GBH, Jared?
The recording of the singers was done here at GBH at our Fraser Performance Studio.
That's
well,
great.
Let's hear a little bit of the sound. This is from the introduction to Fall of the House of Usher. It pictures black and white woman playing with a creepy Victorian doll. An industrial era syringe while talking to us, the audience.
The House of Usher is the trap inside your chest that won't let you breathe, the lump in your throat that won't let you swallow. It's a mind game. So don't be disturbed. Sit back, relax, allow yourself to play. Be a child again.
Which you can do as soon as you can book your vaccination appointments. Maybe.
Okay. You guys have explained to do to me about this Liars and Believers. I mean, I know that the audience is supposed to make comfort food to eat with the players, and there's some messaging going back between the audience and puppets. But what is it?
I think you described it perfectly, Marjorie. What more do you need to know?
Those are all the elements, actually.
They're the elements, but I couldn't put the pieces together, Jared. So
that's
do
why
it for
Jared's
me.
Here.
Well, Liars and Believers is a theater company in Boston, and they had presented this story, a story beyond, which I had seen back in the pre-pandemic days when we could be regular audience members. And this is a story told through puppetry about this young girl's journey, so actually not too dissimilar from the Fall of the House of Usher. But they have updated this, and they've done it in the Zoom realm. So we have these characters who are kind of caught in this nether world, which would be the Zoom world, and we find them all coming together. Again, I think we often look to artists to tell us about ourselves, and we're starting to see these stories emerge because this was crafted during the pandemic, but they're trying to make meaning of life. They're trying to figure out a way to connect again. But what they do here is they bring in the audience. I saw a pre-recorded element, so I wasn't able to see the audience part of it, but they bring in the audience for some kind of exchange, but also so that you have a sense of smell and taste and drink. They send you out recipes and cocktail recipes to have beforehand.
Oh, that's pretty great.
So that as you're experiencing this story on Zoom, you also can kind of enjoy what the characters are enjoying.
Well, you know, you must love it because I know you and I really love audience participation. So.
Yeah. When I realized that I wasn't able to sign on for the exact time, I wasn't so upset when I learned. But no, yeah. It's a friendly audience participation.
Well, you did something. Weren't you called on, Jim? Didn't when you
oh,
go
let's
out,
not
used
do
to go
this
out for
again.
These,
let's,
for these
what was the name of that woman?
Jared.
Let's
what,
do it again. Meow, meow.
Meow, meow. So she does this thing, which
grand,
is like a burlesque act.
Moments.
Jared and I, unfortunately, are sitting right on the aisle. I'm right on the aisle. And it's a very burlesque kind of performance.
Yeah.
Who is and she comes into the audience. She's dressed. What is she in a corset or something? What was she wearing? Kind of thing.
Something like that. Yeah.
Okay. And who is the
Bustier,
first person?
Perhaps.
What? Maybe.
Yes.
Who's
Bustier.
The first person in the whole damn audience? She walks over to.
I'm sure
but
it was
me.
It was
she
you,
turns
Jim.
Around and what did she ask me to do? Like unbutton whatever the thing
yep.
she was wearing.
Yep.
I froze. I was so totally freaked out. I am the only person, correct me if I'm wrong, who for the whole show did not do what she asked the
yep.
person so, to do. It was humiliating.
Marjorie, we were only about four rows back. This
oh
is what Jim
God.
Gets because usually I have the aisle seat, but I gave Jim the aisle seat. This is what he gets. So she walked up to him and the big spotlight comes down.
Oh,
so the entire theater
do this.
Is looking
horrible.
At Jim Browdy being told
Browdy.
To unzip, meow, meow.
It was
Isn't
unzip,
that
that's what it was.
On TV, you're
okay,
supposed
fine.
To unzip.
Enough of
you
this,
should have
Marjorie.
Gone and gotten a lap dance. beforehand.
By the way, she was, excuse me, this is not a strip club.
We weren't far from the old combat zone, so perhaps that was possible.
What are you doing, let's move on, as they say. What are you doing Friday night there, Jared Bone?
Friday night, we're going to give you a little public art tour. There are two new installations on one right directly on the Rose Kennedy Greenway, Andy Lee's The Herd, which is a reference to the ox. This is the year of the ox. And we'll look at Jose Davila's installation that's just outside the New England Aquarium and how this is a perfect moment for public art to get us outside and just shake up our world a little bit. And then I'll speak with the great curator Deborah Balkin about her new book on Arthur Dove, really excavating this major 20th century painter who is a friend of Georgia O'Keeffe but doesn't really get the attention and legacy that she has received.
Sounds great. Jared, hey, Jared, pleasure as
good
always.
Luck.
Great
good
to talk to you.
With
yeah,
the
congrats.
Vaccines.
Well, I mean, he's making progress.
No, he's down to 3,227
exactly.
minutes left
it's
to go.
Actually, it's not funny.
So by maybe next Monday, okay, someone will answer
fine
your call.
Goodbye, Jared.
We're laughing because that's the only way to get through this.
Exactly. Goodbye. Nice
hey,
to see
Jared,
you, Jared,
thank you very much. GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen joins us all the time. He's the host of the TV series Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights at 8:30 right here on GBH2. Jared, thanks again. Coming up, it's Throwback Thursday, a look back at life pre-pandemic. We revisit our conversations with chef, author, TV host, and restaurateur Marcus Samuelson. That's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. We're introducing a new segment, Throwback Thursdays. Now that we're nearly 1 year into a pandemic, we're revisiting conversations that are a reminder of what life was like before lockdown and what awaits us on the other side. We kick things off with Marcus Samuelson. He's an award-winning chef, has a new cookbook titled The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. He's also the host of the PBS series No Passport Required. He joined us in person in Studio 3 a year ago on February 5th to talk about Season 2 of No Passport Required. In his TV series No Passport Required, Marcus Samuelson takes us around the world by way of American cities and the cuisine that's central to immigrant communities. Season 2 is now underway and includes a spin through Cape Verde, Brazil, Portugal, using Boston as a port of entry.
I didn't know that the diaspora of Portuguese, Brazil, and Cabo Verde had such a big imprint in Boston. And the food really preserves the stories between these three communities.
If you represent the Portuguese culture, it's seafood.
When I eat a dish like this, I taste West Africa, but not with the pork. That's the Portuguese influence.
Woo! You can catch Season 2 of No Passport Required right here online at pbs.org. Marcus is an award-winning chef, restaurateur, cookbook author, and, of course, the host of No Passport Required. Welcome to Boston Public Radio. Great to meet you, Marcus.
Thank you for having me. Very excited to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. So, as Jim just said, you're a renowned chef. You're at all these restaurants all over the place. But how did that translate into No Passport Required? How'd this start?
Well, I think we're at a pivotal moment right now, right, in this moment in the country, but also as an American, as an immigrant American, I felt like, how can we put content out there that actually talks about our complexity and our beauty as a country? And I think food and immigration is one of the most delicious ways to celebrate America. But it was really the core of, like, showing America is beautiful, it's deeply complex, and every layer of immigrants have added something new to it, and it's special. And, you know, when you think about the Portuguese, Cape Verdean, and Brazilian, that's like three different communities that sometimes doesn't, you know, get heard. And this was a great opportunity to present that in Boston.
You know, you I think you touched on, without going as far as I would have gone, having watched your show, this is the right time for this. I mean, at the same time, we're listening to a speech last night that had a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric. Yeah. People are looking for a safe harbor, and your show is that harbor, don't you think?
It's a starting point. It's something to have dinner around and invite people in from a different culture that may or may not know about you. But, you know, for me, it's really about, you know, you come as an Ethiopian or you come as a Swede, and for me, I just look at, like, so many people don't know what does Sweden taste like, what does Ethiopia taste like.
I have no idea.
And so some of the best way to explain that for you is actually, let me cook for you, right? So just that simple idea of presenting your identity through food has been around forever. And, yeah, I mean, I feel bad for people that have so much fear around of us. You know, immigrants are some of the most hardest working people you will ever find. And we're Americans. We're here to add value, and we're extremely patriotic. That's the other side of this that comes out. Like, immigrants are some of the most patriotic people you will ever find.
Well, you're Swedish via Ethiopia, right?
Yeah, I'm very confused.
And so, but you think about this. This is a hot country, Ethiopia, going to a freezing cold country.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you when you were still in Sweden with the Ethiopian food?
Yeah. You know, me and my sister, we got adopted. So we really grew up in Sweden. I didn't really find out more about my Ethiopian culture into my early 20s. So Sweden is really the country and the culture that I grew up in. So I'm more a herring and a meatball guy. But I became a Dora Watt and Injera guy, right? And that's we can all do that. And I think that is finding all of these incredible stories that we all have, that we all share. Some are more notable. We know more about Italian-American food than we know about something else. But with no passport, for us, it's really about doing a great portrait to this beautiful city that we go to, but also highlighting the immigrant culture that might even be hidden for people who live in that city.
Yeah, I want you, speaking of living in that city, Marjorie's from Fall River. Mm-hmm. I live in Cambridge, both of which you visited in the current edition.
Yeah,
before we get that, I want you to know, we've been doing the radio show for 20 years. No one has ever come in our studio, Marcus, with two different plaid things on. I've never seen one. I'm staring at you. How would you describe what you're wearing, the shirt and pants combo?
I bought the green for Boston. I bought my little green. I told my wife, I got to wear green. You know, I'm going up to Boston.
And the red plaid
pants.
He's a man
of the world. Yeah. Watch a little bit of this, a little bit of that, put it all together.
So I was really worried when I was watching the Boston show. Well, it's Boston and Eastern Massachusetts. Yes, you're in New Bedford, you're Fall River. I was really worried because I got to watch it before Marjorie did. What happens when Marjorie, who's from Fall River, had not been to Portugalia Market? And I say to her, Marjorie, do you at least know what it is? What'd you say to me?
I was just there like a week ago.
I love it.
Well, it is great because it's got, as you point out, well, the fish thing, I didn't even know about because I'm not really big on fish, whether it's salted fish or not. But it's got Portuguese wines and Portuguese sweetbread. And in Fall River, a lot of people came from St. Michael's in the Azores, and they got all these cheeses from the Azores.
Exactly.
And so it's an incredible. Tell us
but
about
also what it tells us. It's also a family business, right?
Yes.
It started with one vision and dream, and now the family is running it. The younger generation is running it, and you don't have to be Portuguese. You could be, but you just you like really good produce and product. It's all there, right? From Portuguese design to Portuguese olive oil to sardines and bacalhau. You know what I mean? So it just shows you how something has evolved, right? And the Portuguese community, you could be Cape Verdean and there's food that sort of you relate to. You can be Brazilian. So it's a much larger conversation than people think.
Yeah, that's true. Everybody in Brazil speaks Portuguese.
Yes. Fala português.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to say, I'm glad you said it, bacalhau. Is that how you say it?
Bacalhau, yeah.
Okay. So when you ask the father, it's a father-son combo. I love that part of this, by the way. You mentioned the family thing. It only started, what do you say, in 88? It's relatively.
In a garage.
In their garage. I forgot about that. You asked them how long the salted cod, I think, would last, and we've all seen it in different markets, maybe not in the quantity that we saw it at this market. What did he say to you?
Well, you know, the salted cod, it can last up for years, right? And it's really
on a shelf?
Yes, because it comes out of necessity. We almost lost our lines into why people cured stuff, right? Because refrigeration, we take that for granted. So it went from a preserving technique, a necessity, to a flavor enhancer. That's what it is today. You use a little bit of that bacalhau and you make those cod fritters or crab fritters that are so delicious, but you need a little bit of that saltiness. And hey, I grew up in Sweden. Lutfisk is the same thing. You bury that fish with cod. You pick it up a year later, and off you go.
So let's travel from the hometown of Mardrig into my adopted hometown, Cambridge. Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Here you are visiting Moqueca, which I've been to, by the way. This incredible Brazilian restaurant. It's in Inman Square, where I live. Yeah. Here's Marcus's conversation with the owner.
When most people think about Cambridge, maybe they think about world-class universities. For me, as a chef, I think about this little restaurant called Moqueca. So today I'm meeting Chef Fafa. But I've heard about this dish called feijoada.
Everyone knows feijoada, because feijoada we have all over Brazil.
You're here between MIT and Harvard and run this successful restaurant for 19 years. Well, you made a life for yourself, and it's meaningful. You bring the community together.
Yeah.
You talk in all of the interviews and all the experiences, all the meals you have in this Boston. I hate to just focus on the Boston thing, but it is us. Is you talk about the interrelationship between the Cape Verdeans, the Brazilians, the Portuguese, and that was evident here too. Yeah. Yes,
sometimes the history, any country's history, it can be ugly. It can be difficult to talk about. But food is a way to celebrate it and get everybody around the table, right? But also, what I think is so important with the show is that it's America's collective of families, dreams, sometimes small businesses. And you look at Moqueca; it's a great example of that. She came with a vision and a dream. She fought really hard to keep her dream alive. She's been open for 19 years, and it put food on the table, sent family to colleges and stuff like that. Sometimes when you just drive by, you see these endless malls with just names. Moqueca is a small business I kept the light on. It's not about branding. This is family. This is real America. And for immigrants, very often food is the first industry we can enter into and make us be part of the larger community.
We're talking to Marcus Samuelson. Season 2 of The Great No Passport Required on PBS, I should say, has recently begun.
So you went to Houston,
yes,
and talked about the Nigerian, Senegalese, and Liberian communities there. So what's some of the things about their food?
Well, you know, Houston, first of all, is the most diverse city in the country. And
I
think those are great surprises, right?
Yeah.
We might not think about Texas as a super diverse place. It is. And then how did the Nigerian...
Unlike Iowa, by the way, if you're comparing, I want to be clear. Go ahead.
Yes. So Houston has had this tradition with Nigerian community for a long time. Started with universities, started with oil. And now their food is being part of, like, we know there's great Vietnamese food in Houston, but it's amazing West African food. So I had to, for the very first time, I had to eat fufu with fish stew, and I had to learn in a different eat in a different way, and I loved it. It was so much fun.
How did you get to be a chef, being growing up in Sweden, being a doctor from Ethiopia? What did this happen? Were you like making good cheese and eggs in fifth grade or something like that?
I have to tell you, I love my grandmother, but she was also very much pro child labor. Me and my sister, bless her heart. If you came to her house, you had to eat. We ate very well, but it was a clear choice.
Yeah.
You go up to grandma's house, you're working. There was always something that had to be done, right? You know, pickling beets, going apple picking, rolling meatballs, making bread. So literally, I loved it. My sister not so much, but I loved it. And then I got a scholarship very, very young in Sweden. I got a chance to go to Japan very early in my career. And, just been cooking ever since.
So, Marcus, Marjorie asked how you got started with the show. How'd you get started cooking? How'd you get the job to do Obama's first state dinner? Did you know the Obamas beforehand?
Well, you know, the good thing about that is I don't think I'm going to get the call now.
What?
So I don't have to worry about that. But the first, just saying, but the Obama's first state dinner was absolutely amazing. It was one of those things that I was so nervous before. And, I called my mom from the White House. Actually, I called my mom, you have no idea where I'm at right now, what I'm going to do tonight.
Oh, gosh.
I'm like, I'm at the White House. I'm going to cook the state dinner. This is my mother. He's like, listen, do not embarrass the family. If you can leave, there's still time to leave. If you leave now, it might not be good for you, but it's better than embarrass your father's name.
But how did it come about? Did you have a connection, or did he know? They know of you, or what was the connection?
It was about 20 chefs in the country that you could bid. You know, can really come up with a suggestion of food. And because of the first lady at the time, Michelle Obama started her amazing garden project.
Sure.
And the state dinner was for Mr. Singh that was vegetarian. So my suggestion was really around vegetarian food, a vegetarian forward food. And they really liked it. And then there was a tasting, and then there was another tasting, and eventually I got the job.
So you mentioned nervousness, okay. But I hope you weren't joking. My anxiety level, if I were, I mean, I can't cook, but beyond that, even if I could, were you not ready to have your head pop off with anxiety about what the reaction was going to be? Or are you a calm sort of soul?
I thought about it as to do one of these like big weddings out in the Hamptons or Nantucket or something like that. This is like a big wedding. Just focus on that. And I've done that so many times. So because if I'm nervous, the 30 or 40 cooks that I was leading at the time would have been nervous too. So it's about, all right, Marcus, like you have a job to do, now do it. And it was a lot of fun. And the best memory about everything was after the steak dinner, the Obamas were kind enough to, this is after shaking 400 people's hands, by the way, come back in the kitchen and talk to all the cooks and the dishwashers, shake their hands and really make it something that obviously they would never forget the day anyway, but that will never forget that they took time and really talked to us.
You know, one more thing about a steak dinner. You mentioned that, you know, you have the tastings and the tastings. So long before you're actually going to go there, you know everything that's going to be served that night.
Yeah.
And do you negotiate it at all? Or, I mean, you mentioned the vegetarian dishes, but if somebody wanted, you know, a steak, I mean, do you have to do a bunch of different things or what?
That. You know, next one time I'm going to do a steak dinner, are you going to come with me?
Absolutely.
And we're going to do it together. No, there's a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
But there's so many different logistics. Safety is number one. Number one.
I mean, in terms of alert allergies.
All aspects of that. So it's a lot of negotiating back and forth, but it has to be delicious. And it has to be about breaking bread, right? So food can also signal a lot of stuff. At that dinner, we served cornbread, but we also served chapatis. We served collard greens, but we also served a curry dish. So you can signal sort of like Americana. Yeah. And India at the same time at a dinner.
And do they have the state-of-the-art equipment in the White House?
Here she goes.
Or is it a little bit, you know, passe?
And did you steal any ashtrays? I mean, let's get down to it, Marcus.
I love that. Are you going to do inventory with me?
I just wonder. Yeah. I figure they've got the latest in all the cooking accoutrements, but maybe they don't.
It was a good kitchen.
It was a good kitchen.
It was good times.
Okay.
So where'd you go? Where are the I know you went to Philly, my original hometown. Yeah. You were in Las Vegas. Where are you in season two?
So in Philly, we did Italian-American food, going to South Street, to the Italian market, the oldest market, open-air market in America.
Wow.
In Las Vegas, it's going to be Chinese-American culture. You know, I don't think we would be anywhere without Chinese immigrant culture into this country in terms of food. I think the Chinese and the Mexican Italians, probably the three immigrant culture that added the most to the American food scene. Then in Los Angeles, Armenia, we did an Armenian episode, which was unbelievable. This tiny country has such a rich history. And then we started off at Seattle with Filipino culture.
So are you the inevitable comparison? I'm sure you've had to deal with this about 1,000 times, is with the late legendary Anthony Bourdain. He was with us once, and I have to say we were all so smitten. But you do, I hope you take this, okay, since I think he was the master of this craft, you do a variation of theme. Your ability through food to introduce us to culture in ways that I think if we were getting a TED Talk or a lecture would never work. But you are Bourdain-esque. Are you okay with that? Or
Anthony was a big mentor for me. And
oh, really?
We traveled together. I took him back to my home country in Ethiopia. We cooked together. And, you know, this appetite for long storytelling about food wouldn't be here without people like Anthony Bourdain, without the Beard Foundation, without things like PBS that actually, you know, with Julia and Shaq really started to introduce food to America in a different way. But Anthony, the way he told stories, nobody's going to be able to, you know, fill that void again. But all we can do is to really honor him by doing really good food storytelling.
Speaking of good food and good food storytelling, you mentioned the Beard Foundation. You won a Beard Award. Were you like 11 or how old were you? I'm serious.
Yeah,
you were a kid,
young,
weren't you?
Yeah,
How does that change your life?
It's one of these things that you party and you have a good time, and then I put it away, right? Because I don't want any of this stuff. I have it in a drawer. Because my grandmother would still say to me, this doesn't mean you can cook. And she would like, you know, like so. But I love it for the team, and it's acknowledged all the work and all of that stuff. But as a creative person, you got to put that stuff away because you still got to keep the eye on what matters. And that's really about delicious food and learning more about it.
What happened to your sister? Did she become a lawyer?
She's a sweetheart.
Oh, she's a sweetheart.
Yeah, she would love you for saying that. You know, like, yeah,
it just didn't do it for her. The cooking didn't.
Yeah. But she loves to eat, and every summer we stay at our house together for a week and we cook. And she still thinks she's a better cook than me. And I'm gonna she can win that one.
We'll send her a tape. Where is good Swedish food on the East Coast?
Oh my God.
I'm trying to think. I think I've eaten every ethnic. Yeah. I've eaten. There's a great Ethiopian restaurant in Central Square in Cambridge, actually.
Ethiopian coffee is so delicious.
But is there a great Swedish restaurant?
You got to go to New York. That's you have a restaurant, Aquavit, where I started cooking.
Of course, that's right.
It's a Swedish restaurant. But again, Scandinavian food is delicious, but it's hard to find.
And why is that? I mean, in light of the fact that there is such an appetite, a horrible pun, for food from different parts of the world.
Food travels in a couple of ways, right? Massive population like China and India, or massive immigration, let's say in Mexico or South America. And Sweden has a small population and also not a huge immigrant population, right? So it's hard kind of to get out of it, you know. Now people can argue that, you know, there is that furniture store that sells Swedish food.
That's right.
But that's not Swedish food.
The meatballs are not—they're not real Swedish food. No, from IKEA.
Did you ever find any meat in the meatballs? That's a question. That if you find the meat in the meatball, call me.
Yeah, we are talking about IKEA, where people. Jim spent hours.
I love those Swedish meatballs.
Yeah.
You know, Marcus, before you go, do you mind if I give you a little advice?
Yes.
I would suggest. I mean, you're wildly successful. I know that. If you could find a plaid jacket to go with the rest of the look, I think you have really, really got
That's
it made.
It.
He's fashion forward.
I say that with love. I hope you know
thank
that.
You. Appreciate that.
He's very daring.
That.
He's very daring. Marcus Samuelson is an award-winning chef. His new cookbook is The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. He's also the host of PBS No Passport Required, which you can catch online at pbs.org. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we're going to have Ask the Attorney General with us. Maura Healey will be taking our questions and your calls from 1 to 2 o'clock. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aidan Conley, and Mackenzie Farkas, our engineers, John the Claw Parker, and the engineers who keep our remote studios running, Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein. What is on the award-winning Jim Bradley Show tonight at 7 o'clock on Channel 2?
Well, it happens actually to be award-winning. Thank you for mentioning
that. The Nobel is next.
Senator Sonia Chang Diaz, who's the chair of the Racial Equity, Civil Rights, and Inclusion Committee at the State House, and Boston's first chief resilience officer, Tia Martin, who's a member of the Black Boston COVID-19 Coalition. They're both testifying at today's legislative oversight hearing of the governor's handling of the vaccine rollout. They will both join me, as will Elizabeth Englander and Catherine Covino, who have written this great new book for 8 to 12-year-olds. It's called The Insanely Awesome Pandemic Playbook, a humorous mental health guide for kids. And it is an awesome mental health guide for kids. We'll talk about it.
Good.
That's tonight on Boston, on Greater Boston.
Yeah, that sounds really good. I think we could use
good.
That book, Jim, around this time.
Yeah, some adults could use it, too.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks again for tuning in. Hope you can tune in tomorrow and have a great afternoon.